Welcome, fans of the Justice League Universe. My name is Sam, and with me today is Mark from DC Cinematic Minute, DCEU Minute. I would say a sibling podcast of our podcast. We've collaborated together on other things, but Mark, thanks so much for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Yeah, Mark has talked for many, many hours about DC movies and the DCEU, and I'm going to have him talk for a couple more hours as we are doing a commentary of The Suicide Squad. We're going to sync it right up with the movie. But Mark, you know, what kind of brought you to the DC movies and what keeps you around talking about the DC movies?
Man, to me, there's always this inspiring part about it, empowering part about it from superheroes, but empowering to do like the right thing. It, even today, as I watch superhero movies nowadays, it's always to look into how heroes inspire you to do be a better person as you leave the theater, right? So I always think of it as it's almost like church for geeks and nerds a little bit who like comic books. Probably, you know, that's a great way to start this movie, The Suicide Squad. I'm sure there's we reach a time in comic books where we try to do darker things, more subversive things. When it comes to DC Comics specifically, what keeps me around is the lore of it, and that you very much find in a movie like this. Speaking about another movie that's recently come out, James Wan's second Aquaman film, and that solidified what it is that I love about DC movies and DC comics in general, is the lore of the entire universe, but really like on this planet, like all the different biomes and worlds that we have. And with the Suicide Squad, those villains come from a different part of the DC cinematic or DC comics world that you know of, like Gotham or, you know, Central City. So those things, it's like, it's tangible to me now. And I like, I know who this is, and I know where they're from, and I know who their hero is. And, you know, so that stuff I've just been really connected to.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I've been a guest on your podcast. You've talked about quite a few of the movies minute by minute, going through them. So where could people find it if they wanted to hear more from you guys on the DC Cinematic Minute podcast?
Oh, I mean, we are on anywhere that you get your podcast. It's very funny how nowadays, whenever you hear an advertisement for a podcast, they no longer say where to find it. They just put on there wherever you listen to podcasts. This is how they say it nowadays, because it's literally anywhere you can find it. It is part of Dueling Genre, which is a like big conglomerate of all different shows that are show run by different podcasters. We have audio dramas and, you know, original works, but we also have a lot of movies by minute podcasts. So you can find all different types, not just DC Cinematic Minute like Nathan and I do. Nathan and I just so happen to do the DC Cinematic Minute ones because we really enjoy the DC cinematic movies that have started with Man of Steel up into where we are now with Aquaman 2. And we really wanted to defend what we really love about those movies, and not so much as challenge those who dislike those movies, but also, but really have a conversation with them and talk about something we can agree on, the things that, that work for us, things that we love about it, and things that we wish could happen in this cinematic universe. So we've always had like such a warm conversation about the DC movies that we see.
Yeah, and it's fun because going minute by minute, you never know what will come out because you're spending time really looking at a minute. So you might notice really particular details, but then you also might connect it to something else in the world or your life, because you're really thinking about each minute throughout the movie. So yeah, it's a lot of fun. I enjoy being guest on there. Thanks for inviting me. Glad we get to do this, because you guys have done quite a few of the movies, but you have not covered The Suicide Squad. So I'm actually curious to hear some of your thoughts about this movie as we go through it.
Yeah.
So we're going to try to sync up and look at James Gunn's The Suicide Squad from 2021. We are paused at the 13-second mark, so if you want to sync and listen with us, you can. We're 13 seconds in, at least that's what it shows on mine. Mm-hmm. Where I tried to pause it was when the colorful WB logo starts and the Johnny Cash starts, there's a shadow that like moves down the WB logo, and I paused it right at the bottom tip when the shadow gets to the bottom tip of the WB logo, and it shows 13 seconds. So, Mark, let's do a 3, 2, 1, and then hit play.
Yeah, right? Of course. And just to let the viewers know, I'm watching this on Max, and when you skip the preview ad, it takes you to 2 hours, 12 seconds, and 05 seconds
remaining.
And what I did is I let it play for about 13 seconds. So now it says 2 hours, 11 minutes, and 52 seconds. So it should be right around there.
And you're still looking at that nice WB logo with
that
the color
WB.
Scheme.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. Yeah, I like it when the logo has the color scheme or the feel of the movie. It's a minor thing, but I always like it where it's already tied into the design style.
Yes.
But all right, let's go ahead and we'll do 3, 2, 1 play. So let's go 3, 2, 1 play. Here we go with The Suicide Squad. And I know you guys did cover the original Suicide Squad. To me, this is a sequel. I know people try to say, oh, it's a reboot. It's a soft reboot, blah, blah. I'm like, I don't know. It's a sequel.
It's a sequel.
It's literally several of the characters carry forward. It's just a new director, a new creative team. It's a sequel that has a new creative team. That's what it is to me.
Yeah. And yes. And you see that in comic books to this day of just continuing with what they had, but you know, they'll slap number one on there, but really it's a continuation and new creative team. When we covered Suicide Squad Minute, it too had the title cards, WB, DC. It all had the David Ayer aesthetic of that Suicide Squad.
Yeah, the kind of neon light kind of style.
Yeah, the greens and the pinks and all that good stuff. Yeah.
So this scene, when I first saw it, I like the turn from the reflection to him. And he's bouncing a ball, so it's kind of like, wait, he's bouncing a ball. At first, like, literally, I thought this was kind of lame, but then when he had the wall marked and it bounces all around and he gets to it, then it really sends a lot. Yeah, it communicates a lot in a very little amount of time. First of all, he's been there a lot because he knows exactly where every bounce is. And number two, he's very accurate and very, like, precise with his attacks, and he's violent. He just killed an animal for no reason. So, like, in 1 minute, they communicated a lot of info about this character. Amanda Waller comes in. It ends up all being a misdirection, but to me it was pretty effective because it's like, oh, they're setting up this guy. He's going to be intense, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So this is Michael Rooker. He's playing Savant. Obviously it's the, you know, D-list Suicide Squad character. We're
and that guy back there is the creator of Suicide Squad in the back.
Yeah. Yeah. That was John F. Ostrander. He's a scientist who plants a bomb in their neck. He's literally kind of metaphoric, right? He's like, he created this. He also set them up here in the movie, so it's a very nice touch. Viola Davis returning as Amanda Waller. We have Rick Flagg here.
Yep, Kinnaman's back in. So again, it's like, yeah, bringing those main characters. And to me, it makes sense. You know, they formed the team, so they're still the ones kind of pulling the team around. Boomerang's another one from before. A little bit different costume, but...
Oh, I never see that. Would be a minute by minute thing is to
for you. This probably seems super fast, right? We've just gone through 3 minutes and your head is probably spinning. Cause...
Yes, that's the problem with movies by minute. But because you caught that, I would never have known, like, oh, you know, that Captain Boomerang is wearing a different outfit from the last film.
Yeah, it just seems a little more blue, a little bit more color pop. I have analyzed it. But now, okay, we got Mongol. They're kind of announcing the team. We got the big flag. Like, this is, again, it's kind of a corrupted, you know, deviant sort of U.S. operation that's off the books. You know, so it's almost a little bit sarcastic with the U.S. flag there because this is not a sanctioned, like, above board kind of mission. This is the Suicide Squad.
You know? Yeah, it's super satirical. It's super, you know, we'll see it end up being subversive. But, like, yeah, the, you know, the team that we have here, being, you know, Weasel played by Sean Gunn. Already we have kind of like this feel that comes from James Gunn doing a comic book movie and then people like relating to it already because they've seen Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 1 and 2.
Yeah, with a team, you know, kind of a ragtag team of misfits or, you know, different people. And now we're showing the office. So this kind of dichotomy of the office scenes versus the team out in the field is going to be, you know, something that goes on throughout the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so this is where James Gunn really starts to take control of the Suicide Squad's kind of mythos is by building out what Amanda Waller's team looks like. If we remember from the last film, it was like Amanda Waller and everyone else that wasn't the supervillains was like expendable. We saw it was clearly expendable in the kind of the attack on Midway City. But now here you have Steve Aggie and, you know, all these other characters that are Jennifer Holland, Amelia Harcourt is here. Like a lot of characters you end up seeing in Peacemaker.
Yeah.
And their legacy, their continuation, it becomes
right. It's characters that are actually going to be around. You can kind of get connected to them for a while, juxtaposed with a lot of these people on screen that are going to die very soon.
Yeah.
I mean, so to me, this is also James Gunn coming with concept. He's like, it's the Suicide Squad. I'm going to kill off quite a few of them in the first, you know, opening sequence of the movie. I think that's a clear creative choice. To me, it fits with Suicide Squad. I mean, I haven't read a lot of Suicide Squad comics, but I've read probably four or five like collected editions from different, you know, writers and artist teams. But I mean, this is the Suicide Squad. You would kill off, and Amanda Waller is brutal enough that she would just play with people's lives for her, you know, machinations that she has going on and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. This is totally what you should do with the Suicide Squad, is have villains very expendable.
Yeah.
In this moment.
You get to play with them a little bit here. Like, you get to hear a little bit of their interactions, you know, just be like, man, this is a weird bunch of people. But then, you know, they're going to be dead in a few minutes. So both of those things, the fact that it's such a weird grouping is also Suicide Squad-like, and then them being expendable is very Suicide Squad-like. So you mentioned, like, James Gunn and, like, the trust that the audience has and stuff. So for me, to be honest, I've been hit or miss on James Gunn before this. So, like, first Guardians of the Galaxy was good. Some of his earlier stuff, I liked some of it, didn't love all of it. Guardians of the Galaxy 2 is, like, my least favorite Marvel movie. I really did not like that movie. The third one ended up being a little bit better in my book. But like, when I came to watch this, I was actually kind of pessimistic. I was like, yeah, I've liked a little bit of James Gunn, but I've disliked some of James Gunn as well. And actually, as I watched this movie, he won me over. I'll try to like point out how he won me over. But like, I actually ended up surprising myself and really liking this movie.
To kind of set the tone for this movie, or really the success of it, and kind of like my thoughts on it, is that it was very bitter entering this and having to talk about a movie that is like great and successful, where so many other DC directors have struggled. And you see it in the confidence that studios have for James Gunn, and this confidence that moviegoers have for James Gunn, that, you know, he's worked for this, he's earned it. He gets to play around with things he loves, like he's very passionate about the DC universe. And so you get to see someone kind of rewarded for their merit. And that's great and all, but what's bitter about it is to see other directors go and have a much harder time with it without getting any kind of sympathy for it.
Yeah.
So then you watch the Suicide Squad and you say, well, yeah, look, yeah, it's great. It's a great movie. You know, I choose not to hate on a movie out of jealousy, right? It is a great movie, and I will, you know, I proudly admit that it's a great movie. It just sucks that David Ayer, Zack Snyder, yeah, Patty Jenkins, those that tried to establish this DC universe were pretty much like scorched for
yeah, they weren't given,
trying to.
They weren't given the trust and the freedom like from the studio that sort of James Gunn came in and got pretty much full creative control. Yeah.
Yeah.
I was thinking too about how it worked, you know, because I'm open to different styles of movies. And so for me here, it was like when Weasel dropped in, that's a funny gag that he can't swim. But to me, what also makes it work was that it also went to Waller and like Waller's slow turnover. And then the people in the office being so like caught with their pants down because they didn't check about Weasel. Like, to me, it's like, it's not just the first joke. They actually let that joke sink in to sort of like a second joke and a follow-up joke that to me makes the whole thing work more rather than like a one-liner that's just trying to go for a quick laugh. It's like, no, they're letting the whole moment land and it is funny.
Yeah, yeah. What happens with Weasel is very much like it sets the tone. It's like, you know, everything is going to be subverted in this movie. The whole point of Suicide Squad is to get DC characters to be in an environment of subversion. That's always been its thing. Let's kill off some of these DC characters that there's no stakes to have them. So, you know, we have characters like Mongal, who's like a gender bent version of Mongol. And, you know, we have characters like Blackguard, played by Pete Davidson, who was just like, well, you're just like any other Batman villain, pretty much. So you're very expendable.
Right.
And, you know, just all these characters. What makes it kind of incredible is when they do feature a DC villain that you're like, oh, the Joker's in this? Like, the Joker's a Suicide Squad member? That's, you know, there's no way that character can die. But you never really know because of the way that this... the stories can play out.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, we have the dismembering kid here.
This is
played by Nathan Fillion, who's not a kid, so it's very. There's even more kind of humor to it.
Yeah, and so this is when you're like, oh, there's going to be some absurdist elements to this. So again, he's like James Gunn is letting you know what kind of mood you need to put yourself into or what you can expect from this movie. His arms popping off and then going and slapping actually gives me like a Doom Patrol kind of vibe. And I know you're a big fan of Doom Patrol.
It's a very Doom Patrol moment. Yes, of course. It's of the same vein, including a comic book, the Suicide Squad versus the Doom Patrol.
Acknowledge Boomerang's passing. Here.
Oh yes. Boomerang.
So this one,
that's what I was leading to.
Featuring
villains, you're like, oh, that villain can't die.
That are recognizable.
And then, of course, Boomerang dies.
And they do give, you know, Harley has her moment where she's recognizing and yelling at Boomer. Like, so that does connect back to the first movie. I know some people were like, well, they killed Boomerang so quickly. It's like, well, it's the Suicide Squad. They did give him the moment of Harley, like, recognizing it. But it's basically like, he's not part of this story. He's moving on. Now, this is the payoff from the earlier scene, where you kind of think Savant is going to come in and do something really amazing, and instead he just turns tail and he's out of there. Like, this guy that seems so tough is just totally a coward.
And because, you know, the bird he killed, and it was a totally innocent creature.
Yeah, you think it's a setup to him having some good skills, but...
It's like, oh, you think he's a cold, hard killer? He killed something that could not kill him.
Right.
And so now he's faced with all this death and threat to his actual life, and now he bends over. Something that sets the stage for this is like having Boomerang die is needed. You know, if I had one criticism of David Ayers is that the suicide aspect isn't really explored. We have a death from Slipknot who is kind of like Blackguard or Weasel or Mongal, who's totally insignificant.
Yeah.
And the only death after that would be Diablo, who was like a big heart of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not in the version that we saw, but you could tell that that was what was wanting to be shown, was that Diablo was the heart of the movie. So when he dies, it's like there's so much emotion to it and drama where it's like, that's not what we need. We need Boomerang to die in the movie. Like, you need that to happen. You need to be attached to the character and then killed off in a way that's just like very Sam Peckinpah films of just like, nope, just ice the character.
Yeah,
that's the environment we're in,
right? And the fact that some of the audience was like upset that he got killed, it kind of proves the point. It's like, yeah, like that's kind of what it was for. If nobody was upset at him being died, it would kind of defeat the purpose of the Suicide Squad. It's kind of supposed to feel unexpected or feel out of place, and that's why it's the Suicide Squad.
Yeah.
So we went over to Team B. I thought that was a nice moment of Waller saying, how's Team B doing? And that's the first time the audience realizes, oh, there's actually this other team that's coming up. And so we were let in just like the people on the island were. Like, the people on the island are all focused on Team A, and so is the audience. And then at the same time, that we sort of realized, oh, there's another one coming in the back. It's like the people on the island also didn't know there was somebody coming in the back. So that's the movie, when I'm watching it, even though I had low expectations for it, it was starting to win me over, because I'm like, okay, that's a cool little start to do the little misdirect over to Team B, and then to realize, oh, these Team B characters are the ones that we're going to see. But then
moment right here. Sorry. The bird eating Savant's flesh.
Oh, the birds have their moment in the sun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right, written and directed by James Gunn. I like these little graphic things where they put the little chapter headings and stuff into the world.
That is just super comic book movie. Super comic book. That's the beauty of this movie. Is how much it embraces being a comic book.
Yeah, I remember like the New 52 Flash was really good at that. They would totally weave the like name of the issue into the world, you know, into the environment. It's really cool.
Yes. Yeah.
But absolutely. Yeah, a lot of artists will do that, and it is always very cool. But yeah, they make it work in the in this setting as well. Oh, Savant's hair. That's
Savant's
gross.
Hair. Yeah. Yeah.
It's gross.
We have Idris Elba cleaning duty around the prison, around Bell Rev, and he's cleaning up gum and pulling Savant's hair out of the bathroom. We have Pete Davidson, which is an actor I don't really consider to be an actor, just someone who's...
But he can do this little bit part, you know?
I mean, that's all it is. It's just...
Yeah.
The way he performs is just by being himself. He's a very personality actor.
To me, this also, though, is part of like why this is a sequel, not just because Viola Davis is right there, but it's also doing the same thing as the first movie where you move around a little bit in time. Like you go to somewhere in present time and then you go back up a little bit to see how they got there. So that's following a similar, not exactly the same, but it's a similar kind of template for how you can get into the movie. You'll move around in time a little bit until you get into the middle and the end of the movie. Well, even later, this one still moves around in time, even when you're blowing up the building and stuff.
And it makes sense, right? Like, if you think of Amanda Waller, and then you have Deadshot and Bloodsport, and the way that she's able to kind of leverage both of them, it's like, yes, they have their story. Deadshot has his story. Excuse me. And Bloodsport has his story.
Mm-hmm.
But to Amanda Waller, they're no different than Mongal and Weasel.
Yeah.
You know, she's going to do this. If there's a third Suicide Squad movie and there's a different actor who's just Bloodsport, Blackguard, Deadshot, you know, they're all just the same to her and they're having their little moments.
She has little techniques that she uses for manipulating them and she'll just use her playbook. So like, oh, there's a daughter for both of them. So like, so some people say, you know, oh, this is just a repeat of, you know, Deadshot's daughter and stuff. It's like, okay, maybe sort of like maybe this could have been Will Smith and but instead they swapped it over to Bloodsport. But to me, it also works because Amanda Waller's like, oh, this person has a family. Well, I'll use that as leverage and I'll use that as one of the ways I can kind of manipulate, control them or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it just to me, it also just shows like, yeah, Amanda Waller has her playbook of manipulative stuff that she does and she'll do it all the time. And you're right. All of these people are just pawns that she'll move to where she wants to move them and get them to do what she wants to do. Like she said in the first movie, like getting people to do to work against their own self-interest is like my job.
Yeah. So. I also see this as James Gunn in the best way that he can defend the work of David Ayer and say like, I'll just do the same thing. And if people like it, it's cause like, yeah, just, you know, we both agreed that like this type of character with this type of backstory, like this works, like I'll do it again. And, you know, like thinking about Superman Legacy, like, I know a lot of people are just championing James Gunn to, like, show Zack Snyder, like, how to make a movie. But I feel like they're very similar. You're going to see things in Superman Legacy that will agree with things that you saw in Man of Steel. Because if you haven't accepted it yet, like, Superman was redefined in Man of Steel and has inspired some of the stories we now tell about Superman. Because it went to those places. It went and challenged kind of the traditions of Superman. And, you know, we see that even in the Superman and Lois show. We see it in my Adventures of Superman.
And Krypton.
Yeah.
And even the comic books in some ways. Like, yeah.
And even the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Things like Civil War and the Eternals. Like, it's influenced comic book movies. And I think here with the Suicide Squad, there's a lot you see in here that's, I don't take it as like James Gunn is saying like I'm you but better, like Peacemaker will say, but like, yeah, I agree. Like that's what I think he's saying is like I agree. Like this, but you know, again, he has the confidence behind him of both studio and audience.
Yeah,
which lets him do this,
right? And he was, from what I saw too, like on social media and stuff around this, like James Gunn was always very gracious to David Ayer, and he said that he appreciates David Ayer as a filmmaker and that he's just trying to add on. Like, I don't remember James Gunn ever doing anything that was really rude or, you know, demeaning to David Ayer or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
He is moving forward with some of the characters. Now James Gunn could do a really great thing by like finding a way to release the Ayer cut, but that's another matter. So what do we have here? So Waller did not flinch, even with Bloodsport right at her throat. She's
never does
a tough, tough SOB there. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and here's Peacemaker. So Peacemaker gets a little bit more of an intro than others, which makes sense because he's going to be a central character.
Very, very important character in this film. And, you know, Idris Elba's character Bloodsport has finally agreed to be part of this Suicide Squad. And yeah, so now he's being introduced to the other team, which is now, now Peacemaker, played by John Cena, who is a phenomenal actor. I just want to say, like, when it comes to, you know, pro wrestling stars becoming actors, John Cena in the movies that he's decided to be in, he is always up to the task of portraying this what the character needs to be.
Yeah,
And he does an excellent job of being smartly stupid, if I can say.
He was another one. So kind of like I was saying for the movie overall, I was not optimistic about John Cena's Peacemaker, but then as I watched the movie, he won me over. And then surprisingly, I watched the Peacemaker series and I really liked that series, which if you had asked me in 2020 if I would have liked the movie and the series, I would have said very likely not. But he does win me over. So yeah, it's really great. And with Bloodsport and Peacemaker right away, they start showing the rivalry. Like they talked about hitting center, hitting more in the center, which will come back later. That's a nice little foreshadowing. Ratcatcher 2 is also one of my favorite characters from the movie.
Yeah, this is, again, another subversion, right? You've introduced characters, Blackguard, Weasel, characters that are insignificant and proven that they are insignificant in the Suicide Squad game, where it's like they can be killed, you know, that they're nothing. And then you introduce the Ratcatcher 2, and you're just like, okay, so this is another character. This is going to die a silly James Gunn death. Right. And then the movie surprises you, of course. It like goes back to subverting you with tradition of character redemption.
But you're also like right here, you're not just adding each new character. You're starting to get the interactions between the characters and the dynamics that they're going to have. So like Peacemaker and Bloodsport have this rivalry of who's the most badass, who's the toughest of them. With Bloodsport and Ratcatcher 2, it's like he's afraid of rats. She seems kind of nice and sweet. Like, why is she a villain? Why is she in prison? But he's scared of rats. And so it's like, okay, that's going to be a little interesting dynamic to see. And then, you know, Polka Dot Man just seeming very weird and mysterious. But I like it where it's you start to right away, you start to get a little bit of friction or a little bit of contrast between the characters as they're introduced. And then now we get a little bit of the plot kind of moment. So we're about 22 minutes in and now we need a little bit. We've gotten some character stuff. We've got definitely a lot of tone kinds of things. And now we're going to get a little bit of plot exposition here.
Yeah. Polka Dot Man is here. This is a character that James Gunn, he deemed as the dumbest DC character of all time. So he challenged himself to turn this character into someone that people would fall in love with as far as, you know, if the story can do it. Succeed in turning this character around, which I think he did, which proves like he can do a good story.
I don't know if I fell in love with him, but the character was very compelling. Like I was watching the character and like drawn into the character. You kind of feel for him a little bit, like this lovable loser kind of thing. And yeah, we'll see more of his background and stuff.
Yeah.
And Project then, Starfish. So now one thing about like the humor in the movie or the humor in any movie, it's hard to have humor like work 100% for everybody. You know, like humor just by nature, I think doesn't work 100% for everybody. And so for me, there are a few jokes where I'm like, yeah, I didn't need that joke or it didn't quite work for me. But there's a lot of the humor that does work for me. And so I can't really expect it to be like 100% on point for humor. That's just really hard to do. The Big Lebowski is like the only movie that can hit 100% for me.
I agree with you there.
Like this right here, the Starfish one, it's like, okay, wasn't my favorite, but like the rest of the humor in the scene, I like quite a bit.
Yes. The humor, especially in the Suicide Squad, especially in a rated R movie, it's so hard. So, but in a comic book movie that is rated R, like I excuse the language very much. I excuse kind of like the humor, like it is what it is. You're taking advantage. It's always funny to me though, in a very ironic way, is that like where it's a more mature movie, yet the humor is more immature, right? Like, I always thought that was so strange. Like, we wait to watch rated R movies, and, you know, what makes it a rated R movie? And it's like, you know, there's a lot of blue humor, the humor about, like, you know,
you get to a rated R movie
sexual
for
jokes and
adults, you know, but then you get some like 12-year-old humor.
So it's always interesting that like movies get to that point. I think it's very weird seeing PG-13 comic book movies that have such vulgar humor, and like they want to like do as much as they can within that PG-13 and push it, but it ends up being more immature in the process. And I think one of the biggest ones was Shazam 2, where it just felt like it wanted to be the hardest PG-13 movie, and it ended up being just like the most childish, grossest, like immature movie of the DC Cinematic Universe so far. And I just found it like very disappointing to watch.
That one was a bummer, because I actually really liked the first Shazam, but
yeah, totally different.
What I do like here is that Harley does cross over from Team A to Team B. Like, she does survive the initial one and get over to here.
Yes. So right now the second team has arrived at Corto Maltese. We're seeing the final moments of the first team that arrived. Harley Quinn is having this kind of tender moment with Flula Borg's character, Javelin.
Javelin.
Yeah.
He is the one that I kind of wanted to see more of, but I get that they all got killed. But
yeah. And Flula Borg is a very interesting guy, and just in general.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. But I do like his Javelin. Like, his Javelin becomes actually very important, even though he's just, you know, expendable as a character.
Yeah. Now, I will say something that I wanted from this movie, it doesn't happen, so it's spoiler alert, is that Margot Robbie's Harley Quinn character does live. And I thought, like, if James Gunn had to go the distance, I felt like this character had to die. Not immediately. It doesn't have to be like Captain Boomerang, but I felt like Harley Quinn's character should have surprised audiences by dying in this movie.
Because
you could still include that character in other movies and just be like, well, this happened before.
Oh.
You know, and you can still have Margot Robbie as an actor.
As in 2011 or 2021, they probably were just thinking there were going to be a lot more movies going into the future that they would need Harley Quinn for.
Yeah.
Turns out now they actually could have killed her or just had her do, you know, flashback appearances. But
yes,
at the time, I think it would have, business wise, would have seemed like a very bad choice, probably.
Yeah. In hindsight now, they probably were like, man, we should have just killed her.
We could have, actually. It turns out you could have. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that would have been, you know, something to really cement this film, is just like, you just never know. You never know.
Okay. So here's a good way to build sympathy for a character, right? Show them in agony and like pain from just a bodily function that they can't control. I mean, it's a good way. You just, right from this, you start to feel for them a little bit, like, geez, that must be tough to live with, you know? And then, but you're also a little bit intrigued, like, what are those and what can they do? Like, there seems interesting.
Yeah. You see Polka Dot having kind of like breaking out in hives. He's going out into the bushes to like vomit. Yeah. And we don't get to see it. So it starts to build this suspense of like, what's going on here with this character?
Yeah. And now he comes back and he looks like kind of like a normal guy, just with weird pants on, polka dot pants on. But
And then we see King Shark about to eat Ratcatcher 2 while she's sleeping. He can't control himself. King Shark, also known as Nanue, played by Steve Agee, but voiced by Sylvester Stallone.
Yeah, and I thought a very good, I mean, I like the character. So this is sort of like the Killer Croc character this time, the animal kind of freak mutant-based character. But I thought a very fun one to watch and a good one. It's kind of the dumb character. It's like the, you know, non-human one, but also has some like emotional punch later on in the movie that it achieves somehow. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, and I don't know that this character, King Shark, was in Aquaman 2, but I felt like the character should have been. There's a moment where they go to like this Pirate's Cove, right? And there's all these like animalistic creatures. There's like other shark people. Like, you feel like almost like they're of Shark King's race because he is a god to them, right? And I thought maybe he's there, but I you know, maybe he is, but I didn't see him. So
yeah,
we get to see the power of Ratcatcher using that kind of
yeah, that's the other thing too, is it's not just a little bit about King Shark characterization, but Ratcatcher 2, which you can kind of see, like Ratcatcher 2 is like the empathetic one, you know, the, she seems the least like a villain just in terms of persona and personality.
Oh, you start to see the heart of this team already.
Yep.
And yeah, she's got one of those glow wands that you buy at like a theme park or something. Oh, it's very cute. It's a very cute moment. I'm one of those people, I like rats, so I don't find them gross or disgusting. I don't live in a city, so to me, I'm like, rats seem fine.
Yeah, they're just as fine as other things. They just get a bad reputation.
Yeah.
So John Cena is going to be in his tidy whities for quite a while here. Like, I was feeling like that went on a little bit longer than it needed to or something. Like, it could have been like a quick little thing. Like, why are you in your underwear? Like, but they just have him out there like that for quite a while.
I you know, I chalk it up to the Henry Cavill thing, right? Like, you worked for that body.
You got to put it on screen.
The body needs its screen time. Like, I did this for like 4 to 6 months preparing for this role physically. Like, it's going to get some screen time. And I agree with that. And I think, you know, him with the little briefs on, it's very, it really describes his character. It really describes him when you watch Peacemaker and the type of person that he is.
Mm-hmm.
It says a lot about the character for sure.
Yeah, and it's nice here with Ratcatcher too. Like, she could have held the grudge against King Shark for a long time, but instead she works for forgiveness and understanding. Like, so she's going to try to keep this team together, or find some kind of emotional connection for the team. Yeah. All right. So he found him. Oh yeah, Mile North. Okay. Oh yeah, I like the maps.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So they captured Rick Flag. Right.
Yeah.
They captured Harley Quinn, or did they? Yeah, I know they captured Harley Quinn.
Yeah.
The kind of the regime.
And then they got a reading of Rick Flag, like he survived the beach somehow.
Yeah.
Nice so shot here. Nice cinematography. So this cinematographer, I know he did the Guardians 2 and Guardians 3. He mm-hmm. also did. I'll see if I can get his name up here. Henry Brahm.
Mm-hmm.
He also did. The Legend of Tarzan, or that Tarzan kind
oh,
of
okay.
reconceptualization
with Skarsgård.
One. Yeah, which I thought was a really good looking film. Like, so I think it's a cinematographer with some pretty good chops.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that was a good shot before. And like the jungle vibe is, I always think looks pretty good.
Yeah, we also haven't seen much music from the director, the composer for this movie as well, which is John Murphy. If the last movie that they scored was the movie Kick-Ass, directed by Matthew Vaughn, which was in 2010.
Wow.
And so the next movie was 2021's The Suicide Squad.
Huh.
And then Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, 2023. And then the next film that they're going to be doing is Superman by James Gunn.
Wow.
So
okay. So John Murphy
went from like doing nothing, huge break.
Taking a decade off, at least for movies. He's probably doing other
Sometimes
stuff.
Sometimes I guess people need that, right? So it's quite impressive.
So this is like the first time now that we're seeing the lethality and the capabilities of the team in action, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we got a little bit before in the flashbacks, but like this is their first. I mean, they're pretty lethal, but they're not getting along very well.
Yeah, so we'll see a little bit of a competition here. Like,
yeah,
Bloodsport is our main character, but Peacemaker thinks he's the main character. So
right,
which is like Peacemaker's biggest problem. The symptom to all his problems. So we'll see kind of a comedic, killing spree here. There's it's slapstick rated R is what's going on here.
Now, just in terms of the impacts and stuff, I mean, I think it's pretty well executed, no pun intended, but it is also this like dark humor kind of thing that they're just doing this competition and killing people. And these people mm-hmm. turn out to be just innocent rebels who are actually trying, you know, they're the good guys on the island. So I heard people complaining like, you know, you had the Suicide Squad and you had them kill all these innocent people and they were doing it for fun. And for me, it's just like, yeah, these are not heroes. Like, this is not a team of superheroes. Like, it's the Suicide Squad. They're villains. They're being sent, you know, on a mission, expendable, and they don't value human life in the way that heroes would. So I'm just like, I don't know. It's also not real. Like, these are not real people being killed. This is a movie. So I don't know.
Yeah.
For me, those are my two things. I'm like, they're not heroes, and this is not real life. So some people just were acting like as if this was, I don't know.
Here comes the
a loss of
bullet.
Innocent life. It's like, no, there was no innocent life lost here. These are actors.
Yeah.
But I also just sometimes get the feeling that there are people that like wanted to critique the movie or wanted to hit on the movie, and so they pick things like this. And I'm like, no, it works with the tone of the movie. This is like what they're doing in the movie.
Yeah, this is totally, you know, this is a kind of a musical number that's happening here. The way it's orchestrated, the whole cast and crew special effects, like setting up all these like props, the way that these people are going to get shot and killed, and like the fan falling into the bathtub to like electrocute someone. There's a whole orchestrated song and dance that's happening here.
Yeah.
And then you have like these actors who have to know their choreograph of like point gun, shoot this, do that. And then you get to this, the climax, which is like finding out that this is the group that you're supposed to be working with and you just murdered them all.
Yeah. They thought they were saving Flag, and Flag's actually, you know, I'm with them.
So it's a huge comedic bit here, but it's also like, it's just very well choreographed. It's a very excellent piece of filmmaking. Cinematically, this is amazing stuff to get this whole comedic bit going. I absolutely love just the kind of chemistry that John Cena's Peacemaker has with Idris Elba's Bloodsport. Like the way they hate each other, but there's like real chemistry there. It works out. It pays off so well in this.
Yeah. Now, you do feel bad, so, for the leader that her men are killed. I mean, that's sad. So it does bring a little bit of humanity to it, but it's kind of like, but this is what you're kind of signed up for with an R-rated The Suicide Squad, you know, going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then this also is a great time to kind of redeem Joel Kinnaman's character of Rick Flag. Mm-hmm. Someone that I think over the years, I mean, 2016, so it's 5 years now, Suicide Squad came out.
Yeah, wow.
And people, you know, so some people want to defend that movie. I'm one of those that's like, I'd like to, but I really don't like that movie.
Yeah.
And I know there's a good movie in there, so I want to defend that part, but the movie itself isn't great. But Joel Kinnaman's character, Rick Flag, like, you want to like him, but the movie never really sells you on him. And so in this movie, again, James Gunn's like, I will make you like this character. Mm-hmm. And again, he's allowed to do so.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. Rick Flag. And that's a good reason that Rick Flag did continue between the two, because getting another chance with that, it kind of almost retroactively makes him better in the first movie too, now that we've seen him like in this movie. Go more.
Yeah.
Okay. Peter Capaldi's in The Thinker.
Peter Capaldi's in. Yep.
There he is. Very comic booky character.
The Thinker. You'll see him here. He's he's kind of we've talked about this a lot. Like, you have like your poster child villain, which is like this kind of new ruler. The regime has taken over Corto Maltese. But the one that who's really behind everything is this Peter Capaldi, the Thinker villain. And so he's kind of, having his way thanks to this new regime that's taken over.
Yeah. So we're getting some Starfish backstory here, which is good. I think we'll get a chance to talk about it later too. But I noticed actually for the first time here when the Thinker came in that he was saying, you killed my staff. Like, how could you kill my staff? And that came right after we just saw the Suicide Squad killing the staff of the rebellion as well. Like, so it's sort of like at the same time, there were two staffs of underlings that were getting killed, one by the team we're watching and then the other by the villains here from Corto Maltese. Interesting little parallelism there I didn't pick up before. But I like this Starfish backstory. This is another thing. Like, so this kind of goes to the theme for me was, I was not optimistic about liking Starfish as like a villain here, and I ended up really liking it. And this backstory I thought was great. Like, very efficiently, in just a couple minutes, they make this very interesting backstory for the character of Starfish being in space, just wanting to be left alone in space. But humans grab him, and so Starfish is kind of fighting back in a certain way. It lets you get this glimpse of how Starfish operates, the face-hugging, that kind of thing, which will, of course, come back later. But it's also just sort of like, yeah, why did we bring this, though, into Earth? Like, why did we bring this down and try to control it or something? We should have probably left it alone.
Yeah, and this is one of those things. Starro is the Justice League's like what, first villain,
yeah, officially the first one, yeah, in the comics.
Yeah, so Starro's here, and James Gunn gets to put Starro in this movie, and everyone goes, "Oh, I love it! Starro's in this movie," and it kind of shows this, like, again, what makes it bittersweet. It's like, yeah, I think it's cool that Starro's in it, and Starro gets to be this villain. But at the same time, if Zack Snyder wants to say, like, oh, I'm going to put Doomsday in the second Superman movie and he's going to kill Superman, people are just like, oh, why would you take that? That belongs to another comic book. Like, that's not this movie. And, you know, it's like, okay, but if someone wants to put Starro in a movie, it's okay for them. But mm-hmm. I can't, you know, Zack Snyder's not allowed to put Doomsday. It's too soon to put Doomsday in anything. It's like,
mm-hmm.
It's just like no one's saying that Starro can't be in the Suicide Squad. Everyone's just okay with it, right? So
yeah,
it's very strange to kind of see that. And
there's a group that will hate on anything Zack Snyder chooses to do, and then there's also a group of Snyder fans who will hate on anything anybody else does who's not Zack Snyder, and it just gets exhausting. That's what I appreciate about your guys' podcast, though, is you don't get into the fan wars. You just kind of try to enjoy the movies, you know. And
yeah,
stay
I always think it's
side.
So strange what people choose to like not allow themselves to enjoy. I think that's what it is. It's like,
yeah,
you have so much knowledge that you for what you think you see, you have so much knowledge about DC characters and where they come from and how these movies are, what they're adapting, that you don't allow yourself to enjoy it now because you know so much about X, Y, and Z. And mm-hmm. It's like, just let Starro be in the movie. Like, if it's a great story, so be it. And, you know, James Gunn likes DC stuff and he wants to put Starro in it. No one else got to use Starro. Like, you had every other DC movie before him to use Starro and they all said no. So, you know, it's the year 2021 right now. We've had so many DC movies. At any point, you could have put Starro in it. Mm-hmm. And we didn't get there.
Yeah.
So. This is a side plot that I didn't care for, and I thought didn't make Harley Quinn's character consistent, in my opinion. But maybe that's just her energy is being wildly inconsistent. But it didn't really fit into like kind of the mental health issues that Harleen Quinzel has.
Do you mean at this point, or do you mean even how it wraps up? Because I do think Harley Quinn, part of her character is being unpredictable. So I think it is kind of like you never quite know where she's going to go or how she's going to react to things. But I think eventually what happens with this, to me, does kind of show a little bit of a lesson learned from past stuff with Joker and whatever. But do you mean do you mean this part right now is inconsistent, or do you mean even later when she takes him out?
I meant it as a whole, but
okay.
I guess I can see. So
we can track it. We can track it as it keeps going. Because the one thing I will say here is I do like the design with the very white, you know, bleached skin from the acid, but the very red dress. I do feel like just visually that really pops out, and yeah. It works well. Like it really emphasizes her freakish skin kind of quality by having that red dress on. So I thought that worked out well.
So he is what she wants from Joker. Is that what you're saying?
No. Well, oh, so the reasons are you're saying like that she's kind of drawn in at first.
I thought that you were saying that's why it works so well.
I'm saying it works because she ends up taking him out once she realizes that he's evil.
Oh, okay.
But maybe the fact that she gets drawn in at all is a little bit. But I think it's kind of believable that he's offering her nice things, and you know, she's just always looking for like, what's the next thing I can do? She kind of follows whims, you know, and she doesn't have much impulse control. So not having much impulse control, like in the first movie, she's smashing windows and grabbing purses that she wants, and she's just jumping around to wherever. And here, not having impulse control means I'll eat this food and maybe have a fling with this guy for a little while. We get a little bit of more plot development about the themes with like colonization and the Western powers that are sort of dominating Latin America, which will come back later. But yeah, for me, it's just like right now she's going with whims and she's just going with the flow and having fun and sort of a hedonistic kind of way. But then when she starts to see red flags, she just immediately acts. And she's kind of states too that it's from lessons that she's learned from past men who were evil.
Yeah. It's, I guess I will say that it's, I don't know. I don't know what it is about this that I don't really connect with, but I think I do see it as, this is my, I haven't seen this part in a while.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of it as this character's romanticizing her.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, she's going along with it.
Mm-hmm.
Does it becomes more of a continuation of the character from the last film. So in terms of sequel, it is a sequel because this scene doesn't work unless you've seen the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think her relationship with the Joker and everything that you've gone through sets this up for a character who's kind of going along the same path. Like you said, she's learned stuff from the past. If you're coming into this movie, first of all,
mm-hmm.
Harley Quinn, the character has had no explanation in this movie, right? We've explained like Ratcatcher and Peacemaker.
Right, right. Yeah, she's just, you're right, that's true. It's kind of like you have to already know a bit about her.
It's like no one in this movie had to say like, oh, this is Harley Quinn. Like the Joker, do you know that guy from like the Batman stuff? Well, he had like a girlfriend that he created out of abuse, and it's her. Like this movie does none of that. It just says, you know this character, you loved her from the last one, so it's obviously a sequel. And then this Joker character, or I'm sorry, this Prince of Corto Maltese, whatever he is, mm-hmm. he looks kind of like Jared Leto does in like her weird Enchantress dream, and obviously we see her kill him here
there,
because he's talking about being subversion, right?
And this is the thing too where she's like, I made a promise to myself. So she's like learned from the past. And we also had Birds of Prey in here too, which probably even emphasized that more, that she can be her own person and doesn't need these toxic men around all the time. And she has some limits to her morality, right? So she's like, she draws the line at killing kids and just being a dictator like that. But she will do a lot of other things that are immoral, but she does draw a line at some point, and he like crossed that line. And she's also recognizing like, yeah, I kind of have bad taste in men. So now she's trying to like right the ship now.
Yeah. Everything she's saying right now is she's alluding to Joker. She's alluding to the passive use. And yeah, she's even alluding to some things in Birds of Prey. Like she talked about like how these abusive men in her life will, you know, kill her dogs, right? Like they never just go away quietly.
Right.
Think of like Bud and Lou, or no, she called that, she had one hyena and
Bruce.
It was called Bruce, as in,
yeah.
as in Bruce Wayne. Yeah. So, this is all just tying to Birds of Prey, which a phenomenal movie, you know, and that's another movie, like you said, it did come out before this. So this is like the third Margot Robbie Harley Quinn movie. So this character has really grown.
I did always wonder what happened to that fire, because while they were on the table, they knocked those candles and they were burning pretty good on the alcohol, like on the floor.
Yeah, and but then, you know, they were rolling, so that's part of the stop, drop, and roll.
They rolled it out.
Yeah, they rolled it out.
Okay,
you know? I'll leave it at that.
But it continues the thing here too of while you're watching this movie, you don't know if a character is just going to all of a sudden get killed like out of nowhere. So like that one, you might have been thinking, oh, this guy's going to be, you know, a villain for the island for the rest of the movie, and it's like, nope, he's gone, he's dead already, and it shifts over to another one. So again, the tone, like to me, the tone is pretty consistent of this movie from like the first minute all the way through.
Yes,
some people might not like the tone, but it has a clear creative style to it.
But that's the thing, right? Like it has a very like significant artistic tone. Like it is what it is. And it's not that it's a good movie or a bad movie, is your thought process just whether you prefer it or not. Like I don't prefer this movie. Mm-hmm. Like if I had to watch a comic book movie, I would not choose this movie because I don't want to see it. You know, like it's like, oh, what comic book movie do you want to watch? I probably want to see like Dawn of Justice and talk about political stuff and philosophical stuff.
Yeah.
Or maybe I just want to see Aquaman and like talk about lore and big battles or, you know,
really
but I'm
cool
not going to watch
Underwater
the Suicide
Lights.
Squad and like have subversive, you know, killing and stuff in my brain. Cause like that's stuff that gives me anxiety. Like I'm not going to choose to watch this movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even though I chose to watch this movie, because I wanted to talk about it. I wanted to talk about how this movie
But if
makes
you
me
were, if you were making your short list of like the ones that you want in your life, this wouldn't be like the top of your list.
Yeah. But it's a phenomenal movie. It's a great
movie.
I
gotcha. Yeah.
Very well made movie.
Right. I agree with you on all that parts of it. Like it's not going to be my favorite. It's not going to be the one I would recommend for like all of its positive messages or thoughtful messages, but it has a clear creative purpose.
Yeah.
And it executes it like pretty well, I think.
What I will say is I would totally recommend this movie to people who want weirder comic book stuff. Like this, I would hand in a stack with like Watchmen. Was Zack Snyder's Watchmen, this movie, like maybe Dawn of Justice would be like, here's more subversion stuff. You know, like I would totally like keep this in the stack of them and be like, go watch these now that you've enjoyed Iron Man and Endgame and stuff. Like, okay, now go watch the Suicide Squad and you know Watchmen and like have your subversion.
Yeah. yeah. Because we have, oh, there's his mom everywhere.
Yeah, there's his mom.
Yeah. yeah. So we heard a little bit of the moms wanting to make her kids into superheroes, which to me is an interesting angle, starting to make that character more interesting. And in a world of superheroes, it is kind of a nice little wrinkle to have, like, oh, it's a world of superheroes, so there are some parents that are kind of off the deep end and they're trying to make their kids into superheroes.
It's and a very Doom Patrol vibe.
Yeah, he could go, you know, if he survived, he could have gone from this and into the Doom Patrol in some way or another.
Yeah, absolutely. I do want to point out real quick, I know we wouldn't jump back too much, but that's Sylvia Luna, that guy who was he's part of the regime. And so he's that kind of old guy who's leading the regime.
Yeah, the general kind of guy.
So he burned all those parrots that kind of prince had or whatever he was. And that I want to tie again poetically to the beginning where Savant killed that innocent bird.
Oh, right.
Now you have this guy and he's burning all those birds, which I absolutely hated that moment.
Yeah.
But we were talking about the singular tone, and like you have that there, like these vicious people, these awful people, and they're killing innocent things.
Yeah.
And so Savant and this guy, they'll kill these birds and think that they're powerful people, but the sad truth for them is that they're not powerful people. They're insignificant. And you know, we'll see something similar with Starro when Starro has its comeuppance.
Right. No, that's good. And it also is showing, it's blurring the lines. So you can't call this a hero team of the good guys against the villain team, the bad guys. It's like actually both of them have some of these flaws, some of this cruelty happens on both sides. So there's clear protagonists that we're following through the movie and stuff, but actually both of them, both sides will have some of these things that are clearly like, you know, moral evils and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
It also like connects to the thing too that the prince was talking about, where like the Nazis set up this experimental camp, but now we're actually going to take it over and we're going to use it as experimental camp. It's like the people that you thought were the bad guys are actually doing something very similar to what the supposedly good guys are doing now. And it just shows that blurring of the line where it's like the group that in one sense is the underdog or something can later become the group that does the offensive or the evil thing. And that happens in like real life as well. It's like, oh, from one point of view, that group was doing the evil thing, but then like wait a couple decades and now that group is doing some of the evil stuff as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's great that this castle that they're trying to infiltrate is called Jotunheim. That's mm-hmm. what the Nazis called it. So it's Jotunheim. Mm-hmm. It's very poetic. It even has like mythological to it, right? Because like Jotunheim is like the frost giant realm of Norse mythology, right? So it's like Starro's there. That's the giant that's actually in Jotunheim. So they're trying to mm-hmm. like it's poetic in the sense that like you have these villains going down into like what is essentially hell. Mm-hmm. So as these villains kind of repent for their sins, they go further into hell, and Jotunheim being the Norse kind of like we're gonna go into hell kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think it's very poetic in that regard. But that's something nice. That David Ayer's Suicide Squad wanted to do as well, but it doesn't land it in that movie where it's like, yeah, you're here to repent. They have that song by War, which is like what is it? Slipping into Darkness, right? That's the mm-hmm. song that plays in Suicide Squad, and that's what it was. Like they're atoning by being sent into hell, and that's what this team is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's a very cute moment for King Shark.
Yeah, and very good texture on the CGI character there. A little bit more character development moments, which I like. I also like movies when they have like a clear setting. Like you can remember the place and almost kind of feel it, almost smell it from like how thoroughly it's set up. And I think this movie, that's part of what makes this movie strong, is that it has that clear sense of place. Like you've got the beaches, you've got the jungle, then you have this kind of Latin, you know, Spanish culture, Latin American kind of vibe to the city. And so like this movie has a sense of place, and it's very consistent like through the whole movie. Versus another movie that's just like a generic parking lot or generic gray kinds of, you know, could be anywhere. I feel like the good movies always have a potent, vibrant kind of setting.
Yeah, and that was really one of the biggest issues with the first movie, Suicide Squad, was being so generic looking. You did not know where you were.
It was just a city of some sort, yeah.
Yeah, and there were moments in that film where it would look so iconic, like there's a crashed plane here that they're walking by or something like that, but it was so short, you just couldn't really revel in it. And then it has this very iconic moment in the bar scene that I think becomes the only memorable part of the movie, because that bar itself is so iconic. And, you know, like everyone's wet from the rain and they're all having drinks, and the drinks look iconic as well.
Yeah.
And only in that moment were you just like, this is the movie I wanted to see. This bar scene right here.
Yeah, it has. Yeah, that's the one where it feels like it has a smell. It feels like you are in there with them or something. But then other stuff is like generic street, generic car, generic office building. Yeah.
Generic bad guy things that look like they're from Power Rangers. Like,
Yeah.
It's very, very disappointing.
The part of the reason that Ratcatcher 2 is like one of my favorite characters from this, though, was I thought it was really artfully done how they do that backstory with the dad, Ratcatcher 1, and the rats, and like
played by Taika Waititi.
Yeah, which is interesting too, because I'm not like, I like some of his stuff. I'm not really a fan of the Thor stuff, but I really like his Nazi one that he did. But just in those like 1 or 2 minutes, you just really get this feeling of the emotion between the father and the daughter, and that they're, you know, they're kind of outcasts, but they have each other and have some words of wisdom that carry each other through. But just thought it's, you know, James Gunn and his team, like they know how to get to an emotional moment like pretty efficiently.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Ratcatcher's story here we'll see become the empowering part. It will be kind of, it'll be both educational and empowering. Because it has that Doom, that which made Doom Patrol so successful, is like, you guys are all outcasts. We'll see it by the end of this movie, like what her father is imprinted on her, what she's learned from rats, that is that they are rats, and that they maybe outcasts, but they will be outcasts together. Like they will find new family.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, this is another great scene. Everything with the bus and now this scene, we'll see these characters really hang out and get along. And again, we saw a bar scene in the first movie. We see a bar scene in the second one. The characters will do a thing where they I'm blanking on the term, but they'll strengthen as the relationship strengthening. So you really grow with these characters and enjoy them.
Yeah. I like the, I'm just noticing the really cool color design in here too. Like they have yellow on the table where they're sitting, but then off to one side is red and off to the other side is blue. And it ends up being this really cool color kind of effect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of that. Like the primary colors in this movie become the color palette, which I think was of the John F. Ostrander comics was having the primary colors.
Yeah.
And a lot of times in comic books, I think post-70s they'll start to get to the other side of the complementary. So you'll see more orange, purple, and green. Like you do in Spider-Man comics, you see a lot.
But this one, you're right, because they put Rick Flagg back in the classic yellow shirt, which is from the comics. Mm-hmm. But they have Bloodsport in a blue. But then like Polka Dot Man is like the primary colors as polka dots. Like so, there is a very consistent sort of color palette here. Okay, I like this. It's a little reminder of the mom. There's all the moms. So we got introduced to that earlier. Now this is a little reminder of it.
Yeah.
And just David Dasmalchian, or however you say his name, like he's really good. I've noticed him in more and more things, and he's always really good. He's got one of those faces that's just like, oh man, compelling to watch.
Yeah, very iconic person. And I think he was in Ant-Man too.
Yeah, I know he's been in the Marvel Universe, yeah.
Yeah.
He's been in both. I just might have seen him in Dune, also the Dune universe.
Yeah, he was, he's in Dune, and then he has, like, a new show coming out. He was in Oppenheimer as well.
Oh, yeah, that's another one I saw recently he's around a lot. So the Thinker sticks out pretty well. You're not gonna miss him very easily if he's walking through a bar.
Yeah, and again, that's another thing that James Gunn does that a lot of people would like to see the DC comics be, which is that you have a bar that villains just walk in. That's something that people who grew up with like the Justice League animated series, it's like that was a thing. Like there were the villains had bars and like Captain Cold could walk in and you knew it was Captain Cold and he didn't have to hide it. He just was who he was.
Yeah.
And this is that moment here. It's like the Thinker's here. There's no hiding it. And it's like, Yep, yeah, he totally is. This is a great moment here, just watching the story kind of unfold.
And you got this rising tension because you got the soldiers gathering outside, so you know that the clock is ticking. So you're kind of like, how are they going to get out of this? Are they going to be able to make it through? Now the general's coming on in, or the soldiers are coming in.
Yeah. Everything worked out so well. You know, they came in, they had drinks, they had a good time, they got the bad guy, they're walking out, and then things are getting a little hairy, so we gotta get out of here now.
Yeah. Okay, so Peacemaker's got a small little blade, but that might be all he needs.
Yeah. Peacemaker is a character that is pretty much in the zeitgeist of my hobbies lately. I know we were talking about the Peacemaker show, but another one of my hobbies, besides podcasting about DC comics, is playing Mortal Kombat as a fighting game competitor. Mortal Kombat and DC always kind of connected somehow because they are under the Warner Brothers umbrella, and Peacemaker is in Mortal Kombat now as a playable character. He just came out a couple weeks ago.
Wow.
So there was a couple of times, especially with like the terrorists, or I'm sorry, with the rebel group, and he was killing them. A couple of the moves he did in the game stem from him killing those rebels right there. So the blow dart, you know, it's the down back square or down back one would be that move. And he had the exploding bullet. And that's one of his brutalities in Mortal Kombat. So it's it's totally portrayed and voiced by John Cena. So he had a great time filming and recording that for Mortal Kombat. So you get to see that humor continue in the video game. It's very nice.
Yeah. And I will say again, like for people listening, you might not have all watched Peacemaker. I'll just say again, I was pleasantly surprised by Peacemaker. Like that show was really surpassed my expectations. I know they're about to start filming season 2. The rumor is they're going to be filming it this summer. So more of that to come, hopefully.
Yeah. We'll see this team split off here. Some of them have been apprehended. We have Bloodsport.
Well, and I was just going to say, too, because you've been kind of pointing out like some of the connections. So, again, this reminds me of like in the first movie, some Suicide Squad members that are in like the helicopter, which then crashes and they get out and survive or whatever. So there's also kind of a theme of they're in a closed vehicle of some kind and you see like the shots inside, but then you figure something violent is going to happen and are they going to survive from it or whatever. So again, it's to me, it's like, it's a sequel that works. It's just a different creative team. So.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Like the DNA is still kind of there. Like that which made Suicide Squad great, it's still here. It just now has the James Gunn flair to it, and it works.
And
really
it's also
well.
it's just entertaining as well, because like you're watching this and you're just wondering, well, I know they're going to get out of this somehow, and they have a lot of skills to use, but you're also just wondering like how are they going to do it, you know? So you can just tell Bloodsport, he's acting nonchalant and whatever, but he's like, yep, now you're like, something's going to happen. And boom, they all are able to take out the guy in front of him.
Yeah.
And he's like, I don't smoke. So that to me was some humor that worked on me. It's like the whole cigarette thing was just to get in position and kind of lure them into a sense of complacency. Whoa. And then you get a little bit of R-rated violence there.
Yeah, yeah.
It
works
shot
really
to the
well
driver.
The way that Peacemaker, Rick Flag, and Bloodsport are just the same type of guy.
Yeah, they're all capable in similar ways, so they can all kind of do what they need to do in this situation. Yeah. I like this one too, just the one arm, the one arm of John Cena.
Yeah.
It's good. There goes the guy.
Just absolutely killing this guy. There's something I really like about this movie, the way that these men are kind of like almost like 80s action stars again. That I think makes it's something we don't see as much anymore. And I actually can't remember, was Joel Kinnaman in the Predators movie, or am I getting him confused with someone else?
I mean, he was in a series like that.
But like, yeah, and I'll look it up as well. But like the
original RoboCop.
He was the RoboCop. Yeah, that's right. But the Predator movie, the first one, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Carl Weathers, that to me was like action figure 80s action men. Like that was, it was so like it set the tone of what action stars look like in a movie. And I feel like the Suicide Squad, this movie like goes back to that and says like, we're in the jungle and we're ripped and we're big 80s action star men.
Yeah,
and it just goes back to that, and it's like, yeah, you guys look really cool. I like this.
I like this too. The operation switches to Harley. It's cool.
Yeah, yeah, it works so well.
And again, the only reason that you would know that Rick Flag cares about saving Harley is because of the other movie, the earlier movie. Yeah, like there's nothing in this movie that would show like that he has to go save her or that he would care that much.
Yeah,
but it's also a nice way to just transition us back to like, okay, let's pick up on the Harley story.
Yeah, this part works for me, and I remember this being the part where I was like, she got captured at the landing point at the LZ, and I felt like it could have just cut right here.
Oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah. And just been like, we didn't need the Joker bit that didn't really. I mean, if I want to see her have like this character development from Joker, I kind of got it in Birds of Prey, but I kind of wanted to see it more tied to Joker instead of just being like a guy who was like a stand-in to represent that growth that she's had in the other two movies. It just seemed out of place for this movie. And so to just cut right here, it's just like, perfect. She got captured. Yeah. She's being tortured. She's crazy. She actually enjoys it. That's her character.
Yeah. I might not say out of place, but I agree that actually you could cut that whole romance faded romance part, and it actually wouldn't affect the story, so you could have cut right here, it still works. So it's sort of like it's removable, but
mm-hmm.
to me, I think it still fits. I don't think it's like out of place, but I do, you know, I do like the scene that's coming up. It'll, I guess, be the next part where she uses her gymnastic skills, which are also from the first movie. Where
which
she's,
is also, you know, from the first one, yeah.
She's also, you know, caged and locked up, but doing gymnastic stuff in various ways, and she's going to do that again. So it's like consistent for the character physically.
Mm-hmm.
I like this blood sport.
Yeah, moment. With just the mask
with
on.
Just
and
his
and
mask
tank.
On. The white tank.
It's so goofy. Peacemaker with that iconic helmet.
And he's just got like a ripped or a polo shirt on.
Yeah.
Tights, you know, tight polo shirt on.
It's so iconic. I love James Gunn sticking with these comic book suits. And, you know, and John Cena wearing, like, he's going to wear the Peacemaker outfit from the comic books, like, straight up. Like, he's just wearing it. I thought that was great. I love that Zack Snyder does that with Batman in Dawn of Justice, that he is just wearing, like, a Batman suit.
Yep.
I think it's just really good stuff. I love seeing stuff like that. It makes his characters fit in a comic book.
Yeah, I agree. Harley is doing her gymnastics thing here, which, to me, it's like, yeah, you see the first movie, you know that she's very capable of all this kind of stuff. That's like an impressive, you know, stunt that they did. And like the physicality required for that is actually quite impressive.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Even this right here, like to be able to
go with the toes.
Yeah, she's going to use her foot to grab this key.
Uh-huh.
This is a Tarantino movie now. This is a total Kill Bill part that James Gunn is just doing. Like, yeah, I'm going to do a little Kill Bill moment here. And it totally is.
Yeah. All right. She's loading up. This is also, this to me fits with the Birds of Prey Harley Quinn as well. Like it's reminiscent of her kind of going through the police station and stuff,
mm-hmm.
except for now it's rated R and it's bloodier.
Was Birds of Prey rated R?
It yeah, might it have been. It might have been rated R, but the police one, you know, they went into the artistic like, bean bags and colors and stuff, where this one is blood and guts.
Yeah, and then I think here's where it will change back into that, right? It will go into...
Oh, yeah, it will go into the artistic.
She's going to start having super happy fun time stuff.
Yeah. I really like the camera work of her flipping around the doors, though. Geometrically, I thought that was a really cool design.
Yeah.
For spinning and doing the doors. And then, yeah. This is also, like, just good action
using,
scene. Like,
yeah,
it's legit.
A little garrote.
And that's a nice throw. Like, you know, sometimes when you throw people around, it doesn't look physically real. And that one seemed like it really had the weight to it. And
yeah.
These hits actually seem like they hurt.
Yeah, they...
Jeez.
There's really good choreography here. There's something in movies lately with especially Marvel films. I don't know who does the choreography for the Marvel TV shows. But boy, does it look like choreography. And here, the cuts are great. The special effects for gore and the squibs that the people like shoot blood out of their mouth and
yeah.
You know, get the neck ripped open. And like, we're going to try to stab you with this knife, but you're going to grab it. Like, the camera work is so great at editing
mm-hmm.
that you never feel like someone is standing to wait their turn to hit their mark.
Yeah.
And in the Marvel movies, I'm sorry, not the Marvel movies, but the Marvel TV shows where it's like Loki or Echo, you watch them and you go, someone is just waiting for their mm-hmm. beat, their
yeah.
you know, 5, 6, 7, 8 stab, turn, get hit, like wait, you know.
Yeah.
And you also see it in Dawn of Justice where the nightmare scene where they've got that big one shot where he's fighting all the
mm-hmm.
Superman regime soldiers and parademons. And it's one of those things where it's like you see it. Like you see people waiting their turn to like get hit by Batman. And they've talked about how that was a very challenging shoot. And, it, you know, they did the best they could, but it wasn't as successful as they wanted it to be. But it's stuff like that that is so hard. And with this scene worked very well with Margot Robbie like hitting her steps, of course, and the soldiers hitting their marks. But the editing, the camera work to make it seem very kung fu and like we're not going to show the process of making it. We're just going to show the hits and show them well.
Yeah.
And that's how you make a very compelling action scene.
I agree.
And she got her javelin.
And they got the javelin back. Yep. And I saw some little birds. If we're following our little bird motif, they had some cartoon birds at the end of her little scene. I like it too here, where even now that she's in the taxi, in the background, it still has the animated flowers and stuff floating around. But yeah, this is also nice. Like, I like these little, like you said, subversion of, you know, action movies or superhero movies. This one is like, they're going to rescue her. It's like, yeah, she's already gotten herself out. Like, it's like, that's the kind of humor that to me works really well. Like, they think they're going to be all the tough guys. We have to get her out of there. And she's like, oh, hey, I'm over here. I'm already out.
Oh, yeah.
Bird. Yeah. No staff to come. It's good.
Oh, look at him with this. Oh, man.
Yeah. I like it how they're like, so now there's this dramatic irony because we know that they don't need to do any of this, but they don't know it yet.
And you know, yeah. And so what Harley Quinn's appearance right here as they're trying to climb up this wall, what I was going to say is this is where WB returns to form by being what it does best as an entertainer, is going back to this Looney Tunes style comedy. You know, they were doing this. They're going to kill this lady who was on the phone. Shark's looking at a bird. And then Bloodsport starts climbing the wall. And Harley Quinn's like, what are you guys up to? You guys need help? It's like,
yeah, it is almost like a Looney Tunes bit.
It's very Looney Tunes. It's very, it's great.
The gun. He's trying to console her with the gun.
Yeah. Oh, look at that one. Jotunheim.
Nice.
Again, really good comic book.
And I like that too, how it's writing, uses the three dimensionality out of it. Like, only from the one angle does it form the words. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks very cool.
You can see it off in the distance. That's cool too. All right. Okay, this is a direct callback to the first movie.
Yes.
Yeah, and the same dynamic between Flag and Harley, just like the first movie. It's interesting, though, the cough joke, because this was in 2021 and this movie was affected by the pandemic in a pretty big way.
Yeah, very good call. This was in the trailer, I believe.
Oh, yeah, it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this. So we have the little rats doing their thing.
Yep, I love that.
Rats do this in real life. They'll just start chewing cables. people are eating while in costume. I love that. They're having their breakfast. Peacemaker's eating food. Just really good stuff here. This is where we're in between acts here, of course, but this is part of Suicide Squad stuff is there's always a little heist bit, right? And then good heist storytelling is you kind of explain what your plan is so that you build an expectation and then shit hits the fan, you subvert them. Very easy, build them up, knock them down storytelling here. But it's great because we're not given this early in the film and thought like, okay, well, when are we getting to this part and this part? They're doing this now in the third act. So, you know, there's not a long form to this. It's just like, hey, this is the final bit.
Yeah, there's a substructure that uses the heist template, but it's not the whole movie from start to finish with
exactly.
The heist template. Yeah.
So you're not burnt out by the third act for a heist. You're just like, the heist is just the third part.
Yeah.
And we can get in and get out. So
kind of reminds me of like Toy Story 3, which has a really good heist part, but it's actually only one fraction of the movie, like towards the latter half. Like Toy Story 3 overall is not a heist movie, but man, it's got a really good heist part of getting out of the preschool nursery or whatever towards the latter half.
Yeah.
Okay. So like, I don't need the angel splooge joke. Like that's one that doesn't work for me, but
yeah, it's just one of those things. It's like,
but there's going to be,
it's a movie for grownups, but like the joke is for like 13 year olds or something, you know,
but I do like this visuals like,
oh yeah.
Like super white, and then the silhouettes coming through, the javelin. Each of them has a very unique silhouette.
The bus was like the blue and yellow, so like primary colors with like an all white background. Like that's a comic book panel right there. Right?
I like it too that the driver was off to the right. Did you notice that? Like he gets to be in the big silhouette, which is to me is also kind of like fits the style of the movie.
Yeah, he has a name, I think. Right? They called him something. I'm pretty sure.
Well,
he has
the
a
joke.
Name.
Right. Isn't this the one where the joke is like, how do you forget him? Like, he's been with us the whole time or something.
Yes.
I think that's
Yeah.
coming up later. But okay. So, yeah, some people might say like this is washed out, but like for me, it makes that red blood splatter like even more poignant because of the white rain, whiting everything out, washing it
Yeah.
out. And that is some brutal slashing. My goodness.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things like here we have King Shark about to eat this guy. Now, this right here is a
Ooh,
beautiful shot.
that's a comic book panel right there.
Yeah, it's a very beautiful shot. Yeah, no, I totally agree. Like I think the I guess the rain itself was to really wash out the background because if the rain wasn't there, you couldn't make it as white out in the background. So that's like its purpose there. But yeah, it just becomes comic book panels of like complete white background. You have the character and they're cutting someone in half, and you kind of just see two characters and a big splash of red on white paper. And that just goes back to being beautiful, like Dark Age comic book panel. And that's what makes it so good. Also want to say the subtitling. Very well done. Very well done subtitling. It's always nice to see something. And it's also not a primary color. It's orange. So it
Yeah,
really
true.
stands out.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. They place them well. They time them well. Yeah.
I'm always a big I'm very picky about not just subtitling when it's in a different language. But like things of like if they're reading a text message
Yeah.
or like
Yeah.
how is text displayed in a movie? I'm always super picky about like artistically you could have been more creative.
Right,
You
right.
know, I would be very disappointed if like the camera's pointed at like an iPhone that has like text messages on it. Like I would always find that like, what is that? Like that's what you as a director and artist like came up with. Like you're just gonna point the camera at a phone and just have you know, just look at this person's iPhone and look at the text that's going to pop up. It's like, no, I think we could be better. It could be
Yeah.
cooler.
I'm not sure if driving like a Humvee broadly into the door would have been actually the best way to get through that door, but that's what they're trying. I guess that's what they had at the moment to try. But it seems like something a little more pointed or something would give you a little more leverage to crack through that door.
I may be reaching, but so Nanue, King Shark, he makes this little C4 explosive, and he's showing Peacemaker, and he's like, "Look, Peacemaker," and he's like, "You know, because Peacemaker himself is a child, he's just like, yeah, whatever, just stick it on the wall, like stop being a child." But I think maybe poetically, I'm reaching here. That is Peacemaker, right? He's like self-destructive, and so like King Shark is very intelligent. He's like, "Look, this is you."
Metaphorically,
Self-destructive,
yeah,
yeah. Like
it's a critique on
you're
the...
explosive. Like this is who you are, and
It is
so.
nice though, or I mean, it's nice in the sense of like it's emotional how they don't really respect King Shark very well. Like they just like kind of left him behind, and he has that moment of like being lonely. And earlier on the bus, there's also that moment where he's like left out of the bar scene, right? He just has to wait in the van.
Yeah.
So again, it's like with no dialogue or anything, it's just body language and the editing, letting it linger on King Shark for a moment, actually builds this like empathetic connection to the audience for King Shark.
And I think it ties to the birds, you know, the innocent animals. And I
Oh,
think
right.
King Shark being one of those people, it's like, I mean, he's just an animal. We should.
Yeah, even his violence, you can't blame him for as much if it's just part of his nature, you know?
Yeah, because he's very nice to Ratcatcher. It's just that he would eat her if he had to. Because that's what an animal would do, and that's what the bird did to Savant when Savant died.
Yep.
So we have a new chapter here. They went down the elevator. We saw another cool little comic book panel where it
Yeah, and
shows the elevator button that says "Dirty Little Secrets."
and getting all the Starro people. Starro. Oh, okay. That guy doesn't have any legs. I'm
Yeah,
noticing.
he's got a half a body. This is again a really good set design. Like this is really good set design for a movie. All these people with their limbs in pieces, very scientific gore.
And then you get the size comparison there of the actual Starro. Like, he's quite large. Because in the video from before, he was not that big. So it's kind of, this is like, whoa, we got to. I also like the multi-level sort of villains. And, you know, quite a few of the DC movies have, not just DC, but quite a few of the DC movies have it where there's a human villain or there's sort of like a plotting villain, but then there's also the big physical threat kind of villain. So here we have that too. We've got the Thinker, we've got the Corto Maltese kind of general sort of dynamic, and then also Starro as like this big physical threat.
Yeah, Starro will end up being the third act villain, which is like similar to Doomsday or Ares, you know, or you know, only General Zod has ever been like the all-encompassing brains and bronze and kaiju monster. It's just General Zod has always just done it all.
That's right.
But here we have the Thinker, who is kind of like he says he is like the mastermind behind it, but he's also like, this creature is like out of my control.
Yeah. And then we also have the thing too, where it's like, in one sense, is like, is Amanda Waller actually like the villain, which is kind of also what we had in the first movie.
It always comes back, like this, as all Suicide Squad stories do. They'll come back and be like, well, it was Amanda Waller in the government, you know, like this is a big political statement we're about to make here.
Yeah. So here we go. The United States made a secret deal with Corto Maltese. Yeah, they're doing the, and again, it's like the U.S. wants to keep their hands clean. Like the U.S. wants plausible deniability, but it's because of the U.S. that they're doing these experiments and stuff. The U.S. is just having them do it off in some smaller country that the U.S. can manipulate, you know. So it is this commentary on like the broader U.S. power and how they abuse the power with smaller countries and that sort of thing.
Yeah. And so this, and again, similar to the original Suicide Squad movie in 2016, Amanda Waller had Incubus, had Enchantress, but then could not control it. Similar to like America can't control Starro.
Mm-hmm.
So you have this moment here where they're uncovering that. And Amanda Waller's like, I told you to do this to cover my ass.
Yeah.
Not to expose me when you find out about it. Like,
that's
why I put the bomb in your neck, so that you do my job for me.
Mm-hmm.
And what you get out of it is that you just don't die.
It's one thing, though, that was really messed up in the first Suicide Squad, is it was kind of supposed to be like this reveal that like, oh, it was Enchantress like that was there for this or whatever. And, like, they totally messed up in the editing. They messed up what was supposed to be that reveal or whatever.
Yes, exactly.
But in this one, it actually is a good reveal. Like, when I was watching this the first time, it was like, oh, like, you know, the U.S. is covering their tracks. And Peacemaker is there as the guy on the inside. And Rick Flag is like the idealistic kind of U.S. thing, right? Like, U.S. is supposed to be the good guy. U.S. is supposed to be doing things, you know, that are ethical and whatever. And Peacemaker is more like, oh, no, I know the real mission and I just do the mission. So the Rick Flag and then Peacemaker having the big confrontation for the later part of this movie coming up makes a lot of sense thematically. It's not just the characters. They each represent a sort of version of the U.S. power as well.
Yeah. And in both movies, Rick Flag is the American hero with heart. Like, you think he's just Peacemaker, right? Like, you think he is that, but he's actually what you want him to be. Like, he's
got
the
a moral
closest
compass
thing to Superman on this team
as a human. Yeah. This is, I like this too, that Starro actually gets the Thinker. So that's fitting.
Yeah. This is, again, especially being Peter Capaldi, is a very prolific actor, is to get him to play this comic book character, Thinker. And then you see Starro actually will get rid of him.
And it's another one too, where like you might think Capaldi is going to be the villain through the end of the movie, but it's like, nope, we still got like a half hour left in the movie and he's taken out now. Like, so it's, again, you can't really count on a character going as long as you think they would go in other movies.
Yeah. And this is the closest to personal that Starro will go, because Starro knows the Thinker. Mm-hmm. And so he will deal with him. And this is really James Gunn going back to his horror roots.
The framing, though, like right in front of the eye, is really good. Just like symmetrically placing the thinker spread out right in front of the eye, like straight
like
up.
Like a starfish.
Yeah.
A starfish pose. And then ripping him apart.
Yeah. Okay, this is a cool little camera trick here, too. It's kind of a memorable shot coming from the helmet in a moment.
Ooh. That looked painful.
Yeah. They actually looked pretty. And, like, John Cena looks, like, his face looks actually pretty beat up. But yeah, this is nice. So it's not just the helmet reflection, but they use the close up, the coming towards the helmet really shows the diffused angle, and then the camera rotating as they go. So
I like that. How, like, they did that.
It would have been one thing to be like, just show them fighting in the reflection, but instead it was like, no, we're actually going to choreograph it to kind of play with the angles and then move around the helmet as it goes. So they didn't just have a cool idea. They also like executed it in a pretty cool way.
Yeah, I wonder how they filmed reflection without showing camera. I always wonder things like that.
Yeah, I always assumed they kind of filmed it and without the helmet and then morphed it.
And they imposed it on
it? Yeah, they morphed it like through CGI and then put it onto the helmet is what I assumed. But I could be wrong on that. Maybe they have some way of hiding the camera.
Yeah, it's a good guess. It's a good guess for sure. Okay, so they're fighting over this hard drive?
Yeah, like whether to expose the secret or not. Yeah.
Yeah.
There it is. He kicks it away. Man, like, yeah, this fighting is intense. Like throughout this movie, you're right. Like the team they had, the stunt team and the choreographers, they top notch.
Yeah. Here we have, I mean, we're just talking about, I would include this with Watchmen, right? And, you know, we know the relationship or the, yeah, relationship between the parallel between comedian and Peacemaker, of course, historically known.
Right.
But,
right.
This moment here is that. Like, this is...
Yeah. Ooh. Ouch. Okay, so Rick Flag just got stabbed.
In the heart.
And they show you for sure, like, yep, that is into the heart.
This is the thing that no one wanted to see happen to a character that they liked.
Yeah.
Oh, and John Cena looks... Peacemaker looks very sad.
Yeah, so that's actually some good nuanced acting there, just with his facial reactions. Rick Flag gets one little burn in that Peacemaker will have to think about later. And again, that goes into the show. Like, so Peacemaker dealing with this actually mattered in the show later.
Yeah, this is a fantastic performance. This part, you know.
And then Ratcatcher 2 seeing it and.
Yeah, getting caught. Yeah. Like, this is when you find out Peacemaker is a villain.
Yeah.
And when we talk, yeah, this is, oof. This is a terrifying moment. When we talk about like almost like slasher film style suspense horror. It's like now he's just Michael Myers, right? And now he's just chasing you.
Yep.
And we've seen what Peacemaker can do to people because we saw the rebel camp. So now you see this guy who's like, has a personal motive to kill you.
Yeah. Yeah, and like that's pretty terrible. And also, like, think of how many people have died in this movie. So you're like, these people could die. Like, the stakes are high. You know, you're at this moment, you're like, who is going to survive this movie? You know, you're not really sure. It's good. And so, like, all those jokes with John Cena from, like, Act 1, it just sets up a really strong contrast to him right now. Now, I like this use of the playing with time. So
I totally forgot about this.
Yeah, this is what I was alluding to, too, where it's like, oh, yeah, later they'll also play with the narrative time a little bit, too. Because you're like, that explosion happened earlier, and there the group we just saw was dealing with the after the explosion in the building. And now we're going to go back and see, like, why did it explode? And, like, why did it explode a little bit early? Like, that sort of thing.
Yes. Okay, yeah, I totally forgot that we'd have to see this part first.
And it's also like that... You're right at a very intense moment with Peacemaker and Ratcatcher. And so now it's like, we're going to get the other people into position and then we'll resolve the intense moment that we left. So, yeah, I think it's a really nice use of narrative, you know, flashback. Kind of thing.
And it really works well what happened with Rick Flag and Captain Boomerang being both sides of how to approach the previous cast of the last film, killing one immediately without regard.
Mm-hmm.
On purpose, and then one like with empathy and build up, and you know, you fall in love with the character, and then he dies a dramatic death, and you care for that too.
Yeah,
worked very well. King Shark having a very this is the Guardians of the Galaxy side of James Gunn.
Yeah.
Showing the color and aliens and all this stuff that Groot and Rocket Raccoon would be into.
Yeah.
This is the stuff I think people like about James Gunn now, is he makes things fun and colorful.
Charming with this like fish playing with him. And he hasn't made a friend in the same way, and he's been left out, like we were saying. So for him to have a little bit of a interaction with these water folks, it's like, oh, maybe his connections would be with water animals or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But it's gonna be a little bit tragic in a moment. Oh yeah, here's the dude we were talking about. Oh, he's down.
And then we see the polka dots. For the first time, I think we see this happening.
Yeah, from this kind of effect, you know, like, so he shot a couple other things earlier, but we haven't seen them that close up onto human effect. And this, yeah.
What's his name? I forget.
He's about to say it, I think. We'll find it. I feel like Hector, but I don't know if that's right. Has it?
Milton.
Oh, it's Milton.
Milton. Just that face he just makes.
Yeah.
He's like, his brain is searching for music.
Yeah, this is funny. Like, what's funny is that Polka Dot Man, right? It's funny because of Polka Dot Man's reaction of can't believe that they don't know.
Again, Polka Dot Man, like, he struggles with caring about people because his mom like didn't care for him. Yeah, yeah, this part here, he sacrificed himself to help us, and now he's dead. Now he's just gone.
Yeah.
Really good performance. Margot Robbie, always a tremendous actor.
Yeah.
Really just able to sell anything. Yep, and then the bombs.
Yep, and this is why. Yep. And Harley sees right away, like, nope, that's not a good place to shoot your polka dots.
Yeah, I totally forgot about that. These little squid things, these little jellyfish dudes, I don't know what their name is. I'd have to look it up, but I think it as well goes back to the Starro, the birds, everything that this movie is going to show that it's saying, rats, these, they're innocent. You're going to see here that these things are highly deadly.
Yeah. Ooh.
And you'll see, and again, this is a moment where you kind of think, oh, I guess King Shark might just end up dying.
Yeah. Yeah. You never know.
You never know in this movie, right? And so these little squid things, let me see what their name is. The Clyrax are small jelly-like aquatic creatures that lived in Jotunheim, inside Corto Maltese.
Wow. This is some good stuff with the tower actually crumbling and going, like, it feels like physically believable. Like, you can feel the gravity, you can feel the momentum going out.
Yeah. This is, whew, terrifying moment here.
You can feel the height. Yeah, it's good.
Oof. Yeah, again, you think King Shark might have just died here.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
Yeah, and just again the tragedy of he thought he had a connection here, and
But he is bulletproof. Which is like, okay, you're bulletproof, but yet then the teeth of these Clyrax, they must be so strong. They bite right through you. It's really quite impressive.
Yeah, come on. Jeez.
They're just going to reload and keep shooting at him.
Just keep shooting at him on the ground. It's like, if the bullets were working, you'd already be done. If they aren't working, it's not going to help the second round.
Now my co-host, oh gosh.
Yeah.
There he goes.
Dang.
Wow, what a shot.
Yeah.
What an incredible shot. I was going to say, my co-host Nate, terrible phobia of sharks.
Oh no.
huge phobia of sharks. I can kind of see that here. They do a really good job with King Shark being a shark, like do shark things, eat someone like that.
Yeah. And they somehow got the body proportions for King Shark where he looks like a shark skeletally, but is also able to walk around believably. Like they really did a perfect blend of just enough humanoid kind of shape, but also still very, very shark-like in his head and torso and that kind of thing.
Yeah, and in all other iterations of King Shark that we've seen, well, I guess the Harley Quinn show itself, they do him just anatomically just as so, which is really nice. Oof, that looked like it hurt. he almost, I think is actually the same anatomy almost, but in other versions, he's like this super lean, muscular, almost like a Ninja Turtle villain. Yeah. You see it in the Flash TV show and the video game, Suicide Squad, and in the animated features of Suicide Squad, King Shark is in there. And there is always just like super lean, highly muscular, very modern day, I don't know, animal hybrid dude who looks really cool. Like you see here, it's just like, no, he looks like a shark if he had legs, you know, if he got he evolved just a little bit further to be on land.
Yeah. Bloodsport's going down and down here. One thing, by the way, with you reacted to Bloodsport, you know, slamming into the wall, but one thing that did was it took his helmet off, which I think was just because they knew they needed his face for this next scene. So they're like, how do we get Idris Elba's face, because he needs to be able to act right here, which so totally works, needed to happen.
Very well done.
Yep. Now he's looks and he's, Bloodsport has connected with Ratcatcher 2, so you know who Bloodsport's going to side with seeing that situation there. And now we're going to get the callback right to their very first meeting about shooting center and then shooting more center than center or whatever it was.
Smaller bullets. I think he'll hit the bullet, right?
Yeah, his small bullet's going to go through the center of Peacemaker's bullet. Pretty cool.
Yeah. And it hit him right in the jugular. Oof. Very well done.
Yep. Looks good.
Total comic book Western.
Yeah. Yep.
Smaller bullets. Nice callback. And then Peacemaker will die. The end. And so here's the heart of the movie again. And the heart of the movie would be to tell the truth about the U.S. government. Mm-hmm. So everyone take notes about that. That's what good comic books are about. And call out your governor.
Bloodsport. So Bloodsport now has it. Okay.
He's going to have a really good animation of King Shark right there.
Yeah.
We've gotten more confident with visual effects now.
That's some good rubble there too.
Mm-hmm. Here's our true third act. And we'll see Starro is actually now starting to break out of Jotunheim now that it's been ruptured. And we have plenty of fodder now for our little Starro mites. They do a really good job selling that Peacemaker is dead here.
His body's still there. Body's still there and things seem to be getting worse around him. So,
yeah. Uh-oh. Here comes the remainder of the Suicide Squad.
Yep. And now the soldiers are sort of like, oh, the Suicide Squad might not be the number one concern right now. Nice detail there on the...
Look at that. Look at that bubblegum color of Starro.
Yep. And again, it's like you wouldn't necessarily think if you just saw that design. Okay, Suicide Squad versus Starro the Conqueror. But the movie visually has set it up where, like, yes, these colors work in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's, again, the thing. I guess that goes to my thing of, like, how it actually exceeded my expectations. Because knowing the Starro was in it, and I was just thinking, like, no, that's not going to work. Like, it's going to look silly. It's not going to work. But it's like, no, once you see it in the context of the movie, it works. And the face huggers are really good, really good angle to it.
And I think that works for, you know, if people like James Gunn stuff, but they don't like Zack Snyder stuff. It's all contextual, right? Like,
yeah,
you know, there are people who are like, oh, I don't like this movie. But why Batman and Superman fighting? We don't like that idea. It's like, well, just watch the movie, like enjoy the context of the movie. And people being like, oh, I don't like, you know, Jesse Eisenberg's Lex Luthor. It's like, yeah, but contextually it works. Like, it can work. It just, in context, it works.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I do think it's kind of funny that Ratcatcher 2 is like the only one that thinks about covering your face. It's sort of,
yeah.
It doesn't take a lot of deductive power to realize you might want to cover your face.
She was the only one there. She's the only one left alive who was.
But no, I mean,
there.
Of all the soldiers and stuff too, it seems like none of them thought like maybe covering your face is a good strategy. Like just Ratcatcher 2 mentioned it and then said it to like her team.
You see this guy? See how he's.
Yeah, this is a good shot. The panning around and then.
But you see how he was so forfeit, and it's Savant. They both killed the birds, right?
Oh, I see. Yep.
What he was doing in that moment was exactly how Savant was.
Yeah, it's just like he's helpless when it actually comes to be the crunch time.
Someone more powerful than them. What does Alfred say? The feeling of powerlessness?
Yeah.
And like in that moment, they just want to give up.
Yeah. All right, now the rebel part, you know, comes back around. That's good because you kind of almost might have thought the rebel part was dropped, but it's like, nope, it was waiting for its moment. That actually works. Ooh, okay, and
they have
so
eradicated.
Again, yeah. Now it's like the good guys, the bad guys. Everybody gets their hands dirty. Everybody does some killing. It's like a little bit of a gray area, but.
And here comes the zombie part.
Yep, it's nice.
James Gunn worked on a little zombie movie called Dawn of the Dead with a director called Zack Snyder at one point. You may have seen it.
Yep. Now this is good, yeah. Now you get a whole nother set of bad guys to fight against here.
This would be a really good and easy cosplay thing to do at conventions.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just do the Starro thing. Dress up however you want. You can even dress up as another superhero, but then just put the Starro thing on your face and you can still breathe.
Yeah, the mouth is open. You could make a few of them and just sort of like pass them out to friends or whatever. And then you get to act like a zombie.
Oh, everyone's awake now. I'm going to hear the worst line of the movie, the part that I liked the least amount.
The feed is back up? No. Oh.
We've got a freaking kaiju up in this shit.
Oh,
my least favorite line of this entire movie.
Yeah.
To me, it's just that kind of pandering of like, everyone knows what this word is nowadays. Thank you, Guillermo del Toro. And it's, I just don't find it funny. Like,
yeah. It seems like it's a line where people will smile and be proud of themselves that they know what kaiju is.
Yeah, like
rather than
I know
actually
this word.
Being funny, it'll just be like, oh yeah, I know what that means. Haha, that's like, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, I know what that means. Like, oh, okay.
I understand
I don't think
that
you do.
Reference. Yeah.
I don't think you actually know what that means. Or that it should actually be Daikaiju.
I forgot about that. There was a shot of the little girl. I didn't remember that, but just showing the threat level amongst the civilians. But you do need some close-ups of the civilians, you know, because there's this decision to make of, are they going to actually try to help the citizens of the island, or are they going to get out?
Yeah. Oh, so unfortunate.
Dang.
Oh, no. And more people are just going to start dying. It doesn't shy away from the violence. Isn't that nice? some people can do it.
Yep. And now, so this is also like the first Suicide Squad movie where near the end they have kind of a moral choice to make. You know, and so you've seen this team of villains, they're not heroes and stuff, but then when they get this moment, what are they going to do? Oh, they're going to kind of do the right thing. So they have, you know, they have some complexity and some morality in there. So it's also a very Suicide Squad kind of thing to have.
Yeah, so in the first movie, obviously we took Amanda Waller out of the situation because she would kill them regardless, right out. Like, you break code, you fall out of line, we kill you. End of story. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then in that movie, Rick Flagg says, I'm going to break this wristwatch, whatever. Mm-hmm. I'm going to break it.
Yeah.
Because I align with you morally, and we should go do this.
Yeah.
In this version, you'll see Amanda Waller saying, like, don't do it. I'm going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And as we'll see, the team that works for her will knock her out.
Yeah.
Now, I will say I don't like this part. As far as, like, Amanda Waller's character goes, the fact that she gets so angry, I just don't know that I think that fits her character.
She would be this brutal of getting ready to kill them, but she wouldn't be, like, yelling and losing her.
Yeah, the fact that she loses her cool
so much.
Is that part.
She would just be more, like, deadpan face, like, getting the flickers ready to kill them. Yeah. Rather than, like, freaking out and screaming about it and stuff.
And remind me, do these people pay consequences for this?
So, they are very fearful of consequences, but they don't really come, actually. Like, Waller kind of lets them off the hook.
Very unlike her, I would say.
Yeah. It is, like, it is mentioned, or, like, it's kind of explained away, but maybe not as fully in character of what Waller would actually do.
Yeah. It's just like, well, we did it, and we want to get away from that now. We don't want to talk about it.
Yeah. I like the boots for Harley.
Yeah, the boots are very nice. Very great outfit. It's like, almost reminds me of Emma Stone's Cruella dress. I don't know if you've seen the mm-hmm. Cruella movie.
Yeah.
Very good movie. But the outfit, it looks almost like very identical. They have a nice coastal town here. I just went to Puerto Rico. Recently, and this whole movie has just been reminding me of Puerto Rico, and I like that.
Yeah,
I think that might be another thing that people can really relate to. It's not as pandering as, like, you know, having, like, a Mexican superhero to, like, bring in a Mexican audience. And I know that's, like, me, like, subtly saying Blue Beetle, but, like, as a Mexican American, it's like, this is more like, hey, I relate to that, because, like, you know, going to Puerto Rico, it's like, oh, I know this area, like, this looks like, you know, some place in Arecibo or something like that. But
is it okay that it's getting mostly demolished? Or is that, or you're just,
no,
you're,
that's cool, right? I mean, yeah, like, yeah.
It's part of the story. It's integral to the story.
Yeah, right? I mean, people in Japan who watch Godzilla movies, right? Like, it's their town, but, like, they relate to it because of bombings, right? So it's like, it's just...
Okay, I like this here. So, like, Bloodsport is becoming a leader where he knows how to communicate with each of his team members. You know, is Nom Nom there for this? And it's also the nice thing, too, where they're actually kind of a team.
Yeah.
Yeah, for Polka Dot Man, it's his mom. That's the way to reach him. And this is
very well done visual effects.
I think it's really good. So it's like, and again, it's like, some people are like, wow, that's silly or that's absurd. It's like, no. Yeah, like, they set up the absurd. Well,
I mean,
tone,
yes, it is absurd.
But that's
the point.
And it was set up consistently throughout the movie, not just with the mom stuff, you know, shown earlier, but also with the movie having some absurd elements that are just, like, you know, over the top.
Yeah.
It's also, again, to me, like, what would fit in with a Doom Patrol style. Like, I could also see this in a Doom Patrol show, like, oh, he's visualizing his mom and it looks very absurd, but it works for the character. And then, like, to me, that actually hurt my heart the first time I saw that with Polka Dot Man. I felt for him.
Yeah. Yeah. That moment.
James Gunn made me feel for Polka Dot Man.
And that was his goal. That's what he wanted to do. And he did it. Yeah. This is where I thought, like, not in that exact moment with her falling through, but, like, just in this third act, like, if Harley Quinn were to die, like, it felt like that could be one more subversion. But maybe as far as storytelling goes, like, maybe we're done subverting, right? Like,
yeah.
Well, I guess we got one more with Polka Dot Man. And if he does it, you can't do it again. You can't show the same trick twice. So
right. So Bloodsport was just pulling various weapons off of his armor. That's cool. But now here it's like, okay, what's Ratcatcher going to do? It's like, oh no, actually Ratcatcher is going to be pretty central to this, the whole climax here. Good stance.
Oof.
Good save. They had a good bond developed throughout the movie here.
Yeah, because she represents his daughter.
His daughter, yeah.
Yeah.
And he kind of represents her dad, kind of, yeah.
Very good. Very good work. Using the people to voice Darrow, that's a very good decision choice. Yeah, and I think that might have been what was missing in the first Suicide Squad, was that it's kind of hard for Deadshot to... Well, he did. He really tried to relate to some of the people. So in some way it worked. But this works even tighter by creating a character that represents his daughter.
Yeah.
See all the rats here.
Now that is a lot of rats. So I know there's a lot of rats, but I'm like, that is a lot of rats.
And there probably is. There probably is a lot of rats.
Man. But I do like this. I just like the visual of her.
This is, does it have the scene that, did we already pass like the very iconic shot that you see in like the trailers and stuff? Did we pass that already? Because that's, well, it is, like you said, it is a really good shot. I don't know if it showed up yet where she like is standing up and they're rushing beneath her.
Starro's stumbly. And I liked, the javelin comes full
circle.
Here's
the
here
javelin.
Too.
Yeah, this is full circle.
But you can see here too, like this nice actual ramp that Harley will have to run up. Oh yeah, actually the not just any rat; it's the rat.
It's the Stuart Little rat. That's the shot right there of Ratcatcher.
Yeah,
with the rats running over her.
But she's also has her arm around Bloodsport, because she knows he's got a thing with rats, so she's kind of take care of him. Yeah, and the nice emotional look.
This line here from Taika. This is the moral
the message
of
Suicide Squad. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is why I love comic book movies. They have to have this.
Yeah.
Be entertaining. You get the James Gunn stuff, right? You love the Guardians of the Galaxy, right? Well, you're gonna love this movie, right? That's the entertaining part.
Yep.
The message, the empowering part, the thing that makes comic books so great is that this moment here. It's like, this is a good story.
And that's
I enjoy
good.
This.
That's good acting too.
Yeah.
From Daniela Melchior. But yeah, this the lowliest, the downtrodden kind of castaway vermin. It's like, no, they have a purpose. If we actually respect them and see their value, change everything.
Mm-hmm.
That's great though. Like cutting the way in and then the rats coming in. It's brilliant. Like it's brilliant.
It's so beautiful.
And it's beautiful. Like, it's an eyeball with rats swimming in it, and it actually looks beautiful. Like,
yes,
that's the kind of artistic things. Like, wow, how did they pull that off?
And like you said earlier, the white, red, and blue, you know, just all these primary colors.
Yeah.
And now they're eating the brain of Starro.
And she's smiling about it.
Yeah. I think this blood will kind of consume her, right? Like it'll fade to red almost.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. It is, yeah. Okay.
Man, they're really getting in there.
Oh, that's awesome.
It's
great moment.
Well, and imagine like just how unique that climax is, right? The climax is she javelins into the eyeball and rats take over. Like, how can you imagine getting to that point in a movie where that's like your climax of the movie, but it actually all makes sense? Like, it all works and builds up to that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But if somebody just like popped into this part of the movie, they'd be like, what in the world is going on?
If someone just like turned on the TV and saw this final bit, they would be seeing just the wildest sci-fi movie ever.
Yeah.
They'd just be like, this is what is going on. But I'm so captivated.
That looks like a real, I mean, could that possibly be real?
That was real.
A real set with a real jelly.
That was a real, like, that was a waterbed, right? That was what that
My
was.
My goodness. Wow. Yeah. So now, oh yeah, and there we got the daughter seeing like, oh wait, my dad actually did something good. He's a hero, sort of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The
And the freedom
coup, the
fighters. Yep.
rebellion. Yeah.
Yep.
Fighting for freedom. Doing something right. Oh. Oof.
Yeah. That's tough, but oh, here she is, Waller's. Okay, so this is why, this is kind of how Waller gets put in her place, is because Bloodsport has the leverage. I think she's going to give a glare to her team, though, in a second.
Yeah, she will.
But there, I think in the Peacemaker series, they do talk about it a little bit.
Yeah, they.
I forgot how little Harcourt actually has. Like, I kind of, because I think about the Peacemaker series, and so her character has developed a lot, and I forgot that she's actually like very much just a little small side character in this.
But they're treated as like an on, like the ensemble's treated as a character,
Right,
like a total character.
But then the one that gets a little bit more is the Economos. You know, he's kind of the one that gets the most lines, the most screen time.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a little bit like, now that I think about it, it's almost a little bit like Inside Out. You ever seen that movie?
Yeah.
That's kind of like what they are. It's like as an ensemble group, they just have different static personalities, but they end up being like a whole ensemble.
Yeah, it's one character that's split into different parts. And okay, so there was a little homage or a remembrance of Rick Flag there.
Oh. Did Starro say its line yet? Where?
Oh yeah, like what? Yeah, I liked it in space. Why couldn't you just leave me in space or something?
Yes. Okay.
We must have talked over it. I think it's already passed.
I think that was the dictator or the general, right? He said it. That's what I wanted to go back to again with the birds and the shark,
and
the Clyrax and the rats. Was like Starro was just an animal that wanted to be left alone.
Yeah.
But we took it and we used it and abused it, just like we take these supervillains and we use them and abuse them and make them villains. And, you know, but kind of why their villain origin story is always like, well, they were normal people who just had a bad day and we took advantage of them. Mm-hmm. So the real villain might just be the U.S. government. But Starro was just an animal and we've turned it into a monster.
Yeah.
Or treated it as such. And so it's like America created this situation and then it solved its own situation by killing it and said, hey, now we're heroes. And it's like, yeah, but it wasn't supposed to be an enemy to begin with.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's the end of the movie.
That's good. Sebastian was the rat, apparently. But yeah, that's nice. But it's also, you know, it's not just nice as like, oh, Bloodsport, he has a fear of rats and now he's, you know, petting one. But it's also that thing about the lowest, you know, the lowest vermin or characters, whatever. It's like, okay, so Bloodsport is also showing some compassion to that lowest one. It's like, just like we need to in life show more compassion to something that has maybe been outcast or has maybe been vilified or downtrodden or that sort of thing.
Exactly. Moral of the story. That's what, man. I would love to see more comic books do that.
Yeah,
movies do that.
Now they didn't let that, so that was a very nice thematic meaningful ending. They didn't let that land very long before they went to the weasel waking up thing. But I mean, I guess Weasel also was kind of the most looked down upon member of that team A. He was just like, well, who is this guy? He's just an animal, like what the heck, like why am I sitting next to him? They didn't even, you know, give him a chance. And so he is actually still surviving too. So if I stretch and try to reach for it and kind of tie that into it. But I think more it was just a fun gag to say, like, he's
well, there. Yeah, you could. I mean, the only one to survive was Harley Quinn, and she was the only one who showed a little bit of interest in him because she was like,
Oh, yeah.
Is this a werewolf? I've never met a werewolf before.
She's like excited about it instead of like looking down at him. Yeah,
exactly. And then it's just Sean Gunn being weird, which I find Sean Gunn, I don't know. He's okay.
He'll be in the new DCU as well.
He'll be in everything that James Gunn does.
I'm guessing not as a major kind of thing, a major character sort of thing, but
yeah. The Weasel will return in of all times to blank on the property.
Creature Commandos.
Commandos.
Oh yep. Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Okay.
I was getting there. It's in my brain. I got all these DC things to comb through. Creature Commandos. Yeah. So the Weasel will return in that. I'm assuming voiced by James Gunn, which is just
Sean Gunn. Yeah.
Sean Gunn, but just making weird noises as he does sometimes. So yeah.
Yeah.
It's a great movie. You gotta just admit it. You gotta get into it. Just like I say with Dawn of Justice, it's a great movie. You just gotta get into it.
The way I might say it is also kind of what I say about Dawn of Justice, which is it's a great movie, but I could understand people not liking it at all because it has a strong style. And so if somebody just does not like that style, it doesn't resonate with them, then they might hate it. And in a different way, that's also like Dawn of Justice. So like, I think Dawn of Justice is a great movie. But I also can understand, like, yeah, a lot of people might think it's heavy, or they might think it's plotting, or it's, you know, intense or whatever.
Yeah.
And so for me, it's like, great movie. Some people might really dislike it. And those are not contradictions to each other. You
know? And that's why I wanted to talk about this movie, is because I would never choose to watch this movie on my own. Like, have downtime. Like, maybe I'll just watch a movie by myself. I'm not putting the Suicide Squad on.
Yeah.
And so by, you know, you asking me which one do I want to watch, it's like, oh, I want to watch this one because
yeah,
this would be a time to force myself to watch it. And
yeah, it's a reason to go through it. Yeah, there's good things in here, but you sort of need a reason to dive into it because it is.
And I think it's a great film. I think it's a great movie. You know, I say the same thing about The Last Jedi all the time. Great movie. And I understand if you don't like it, but you got to admit someone made a good movie.
Yeah, I love that movie. But it's also one, where it's like, it's not everybody's cup of tea, so to speak.
Mm-mm.
Or cup of blue milk or whatever.
That's even better, yeah. just don't say you hate it because it's a bad movie. Like, if you come up with that as your reason, you got to try harder. You got to dig deeper. You got to dig deeper about yourself and why you don't want to watch it.
Yeah.
Don't attack someone else for all the work that they did and say that they did the bad job. That's on you.
Right.
So
while we wait for one more little, I think there's one more little thing coming up, but while we wait for that, I did want to check in with you too. So you are going through Zack Snyder's Justice League minute by minute, and that's a lot of minutes.
It is a lot of minutes.
but how are you enjoying that so far? This is on the DC Cinematic Minute podcast.
It's hard to... There's a part of me that wants to like always kind of put them in order. And I always think Dawn of Justice, the Ultimate Edition, is like the best one out of the three. Mm-hmm. But Zack Snyder's Justice League is a good movie that gets kind of messy and could be better. And I think what makes it worse is the fact that there was a version that came out 4 years ago. So obviously like everyone may have saw that movie. Like, I just recently found someone who had never seen the theatrical cut and, like, only saw the Snyder cut. Yeah. And I thought that was amazing. Like, it's so rare to find someone who's only seen the Snyder cut.
Right.
And by seeing a version of Justice League where it's just, like, so badly made, like, that's one time where you can be, like, objectively... This was poorly made, like Suicide Squad. And then seeing Zack Snyder's Justice League, which is like a director's cut of its own self, and then being like, that's good, but there's also messy stuff in it. So to go from like a C film to like a C+ film, it makes it seem like it's not as much of an improvement, but it's a great improvement. And it's a great movie.
Yeah.
But like, we gotta cut some things down. So doing it minute by minute, we do sometimes analyze it to the point where it's just like, you should have cut some things out, but
I think Hollywood
and the audience's reactions to everything that's going on in the DC cinematic universe has like hardened him to be like very uncompromising now, where he's like, I want to put all this stuff in there because I want to do that now. Like I want to do it even harder now. And it's like, it was like what made Dawn of Justice so great is like the Hans Zimmer and the Christopher Nolan and Chris Terrio and Larry Fong, you know, like so many other people like put their stuff in that second movie, which is why that movie's so great, where I feel like Zack Snyder's Justice League, everyone was just like, oh, you've been wrong, Zack Snyder. So like, go totally do your thing. And like, no one's saying no to him now. So he's like completely off the rails. And it's like, someone reel him in just a little bit and it would be perfect, but he's on the right track. And it's a great movie. There's just sometimes like, I feel like it goes on a little too long.
Yeah. By the way, I see a special thank you, David Ayers, listed first there, you know, for establishing some of the characters and that sort of thing. Yeah, I agree. So, like, I really like Zack Snyder's Justice League. I love the conversation we had when I was a guest, minutes like around 185 or something in there, the 180s. But I also do think they could have trimmed 20 to 30 minutes out and it would have not hurt anything. It probably actually would have improved a couple things.
Yes.
And I'm also, you know, I have to write a lot for my work. I write articles, I write books, all, various things. And almost always, if you make yourself do like a 10 or 15% cut, like trim, it actually increases the quality rather than like reducing the quality. And so, yeah, that's what I feel a little bit with Zack Snyder's Justice League. But there's a lot of really great stuff in there. And I love, you know, most all of the different acts and different parts of it. Okay, here we go. Found him in the rubble. So here
like
we
dead
do.
Giveaway. Like it almost builds up suspense, but it's like, it's not suspenseful at all.
There's only one person this could be.
John Cena as Peacemaker. And I think at this time, Peacemaker was already announced as a TV show. So this was like, no one was surprised about this. This was just like a teaser for the TV show that was already planned to come out. And at this point, already, like I wasn't a fan of these characters. And you'll see them show up again in Shazam. And do they show up in another film?
Harcourt is in Black Adam, I think.
And Blue Beetle, right? Are they in Blue Beetle? Or
I can't remember.
I know they're in Shazam 2. But, and
Shazam
like,
2 and Black Adam, I think.
Okay, that's what it was. And setting up this whole other thing that it was just like, I don't even like these characters. You know? Like, that's the other thing about them was that they set up this whole character, supporting character for Amanda Waller, which was this operational team. And I was like, I don't even like you guys. Like, I fell in love with the Suicide Squad.
Right. But you haven't seen Peacemaker, right? Is that true?
No.
See, well, so for me,
I know which character, there's a different character in Peacemaker that
okay. But I just mean like, so this movie exceeded my expectations. Like I said, I was mixed on James Gunn. This one, I'm like, wow, I actually really liked this movie. I think it's really good. But even when I liked this movie, I didn't have much connection to Harcourt. Economos was like hit or miss, a little bit annoying at times, a little bit interesting at times. So I almost watched Peacemaker just because it was part of the DCEU. And so I basically started watching it just like out of a completionist kind of frame of mind. And then Peacemaker actually exceeded my expectations. And I actually like, wow, I actually really like the story, the nuances, the characters. The characters in the show all of a sudden like really grew on me. And I really like legitimately started to like them in different ways. Not that they're all like likable, but I liked them as entertaining or like, you know, getting drawn in to their dynamics and stuff. So even after I liked the Suicide Squad, I still was not expecting to like Peacemaker. And then I also liked Peacemaker. So this is for me, like what I'm trying to give like a benefit of the doubt to James Gunn for the DCU, because I'm like, in the DC stuff, James Gunn has exceeded my expectations both times. And so I sort of am like, maybe he will exceed my expectations with Superman as well, or just with his overall plan for the characters and in the universe and stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And
even though I still don't really like Guardians 2, I've tried to watch it a second time and I still just didn't like he took the tone a little bit too far and I was not with him on that one.
Yeah, I think that's a love hate one as well. I know some people who really love Volume 2, and it's because they've found something. They found the message that's in there, and they like it. But again, I think it's similar to what we might be talking about, where it's like maybe it's a good movie, but you just don't like it, right? It might be one of those things. But Danielle Brooks' character in Peacemaker, I've seen a lot of clips of
her. She's awesome. She's probably top notch in that show. Yeah,
I think she might be the key to the show, because she's like the direct like antithesis of Peacemaker, which is why it works out so well.
Yeah.
But at this point in the DC Cinematic Universe, having Jennifer Holland's character and Steve Agee, as they go from this end credit to Black Adam and into Shazam 2, to reintroduce these characters and having only seen like the Suicide Squad at that time, you're just like, who are you people? Why do I have to care about you?
Yeah.
You were in the one James Gunn DC movie.
And but as very small side characters, though. They're not main characters.
Exactly. And it's like, yeah, I never cared about you in the first place. And I have to like be invested in you now. Like, I don't care.
Yeah. Well. All right. Well, Mark, I am glad you chose this movie. It was really fun talking to you with it, and I'm just glad you could join in. I always love watching the movies in this way. It's a different way of watching the movie, you know, and actually talking through it.
Yeah. No, this was great. I really enjoy this. And it was almost like a speed run of Movies by Minute. Like, I had to like do this a lot quicker.
It was Movies by Minute, but we only had 1 minute for each of the minutes.
Yeah, exactly. It'd be quick with it. So cool.
All right. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Thank you.